Welcome to the Mad Men Happy Hour, the officially unofficial podcast for Mad Men on AMC. I'm Jim.
And I'm Aaron.
And tonight we're covering Season 6, Episode 13, entitled In Care Of. It's the season finale. How you doing tonight, Aaron?
Not good, Jim. We don't have Mad Men. We don't have Game of Thrones. It's like six, 7 more weeks for Breaking Bad. I don't know what I'm going to do with my Sunday nights.
I know what I'm doing. I'm covering Falling Skies like I have been for the last 2 weeks.
Like a boss.
Yeah. Yeah, videocast, only on the website. So if you don't go to our website very often, which I'm sure a lot of you don't, you might check it out.
Hell, I don't.
I know. I never go to I try to avoid going to our website. It's so bad. So bad.
I post all updates in my phone through the WordPress admin plugin. I mean, that's how far I go to stay away from the website.
Cool. So what'd you think of this episode?
Let's see. So I tweeted to the whole world and copied you in on it. My first reaction.
I saw it.
Which, I'm in a glass case of emotion. I gave it multiple tens. I was over the moon. That was largely a reaction to the final 20 minutes of the episode.
Understandable.
I feel like I need to take a point off for some of the stuff I didn't like about the Manolo resolution.
Okay, good.
But fuck it. I want to dance the one that brung me, and it's a 10. I think I've given 10 episodes. I've given 5 episodes 10s at least this season. I feel like a total whore. I need to take a shower.
Is there such a thing as a 1 in your mind for Mad Men?
There has to be the balance. No, hell no. There's never been a 1 on that.
Then you don't have a 1 to 10 scale. You have like a 7
it's
to 10 video game scale.
It's not my fault that
it's also magnificent.
It's yes.
I'm with you. I mean, I think
I know there's a least favorite. I've had a least favorite episode. I actually wasn't that over the moon about the suitcase, which people seem to just like love.
That's the one with Peggy and Don kind of bearing all their emotion.
Yeah.
Really? You didn't like that one?
No, well, I mean, it's not that I didn't like. It wasn't my favorite. And a lot of people cite it as like the high
watermark. So it was only a 9 on your scale.
A 7. 7.5.
Okay.
I don't know what to do because
even
when Mad Men is kind of going in circles, it's still one of the best things on television. And you know, you either get it or you don't. I mean, like Mad Brew doesn't get it. He fucking angers me talking about how it's shitty storytelling and all that. But he's never going to get to experience the emotional payoff of Don Draper coming clean about his life to the Hershey's executives.
Yeah.
Like, you have to indulge in this long-form storytelling to have such an epic, you know, fault open up underneath your feet and experience that. It's kind of like...
Yep.
You know, if you're not a sports fan, you're never going to know the terrible lows of when your team just fucking sucks or gets its ass handed to you by your most hated rival. But you're also never going to feel the thrill of winning a championship after waiting for decades. So it's like, sure. I don't fault people for not getting down at that, but you are shutting yourself off to a spectrum of human emotion.
Well, I fall in both of those camps, both the non-sports fan camp and the Mad Brew camp, because... When I first watched this show, I did not like it. I didn't get it. It was way too slow. I felt like nothing ever happened. And I made it like a few episodes into season 1. I gave it a second try, I think maybe under your recommendation.
Haven't looked back.
It is a brilliant show.
Yeah.
And I think tonight was no different. I'm not giving it a 10 because, like you said, there are, in my opinion, a couple small problems with this episode. So I'm going to give it a 9. Solid 9.
I just got to say, it's a 10 if nothing else for Matthew Weiner having the balls to completely empty his can of ammunition. Like when he said he used all of his... I believe him. In fact, I think this would be an awesome series finale.
Sure.
It would work very well for that. And the end song is devastating.
Can I say we can confirm... that it will not be the end of the series because...
All the interviews he said...
Not even that, but AMC is advertising back in 2014 Mad Men. So, you know, it's not.
Obviously, they're going to have another 7th season. That will surely be the final season. Question for you: Are we? Is this the last Mad Men podcast? I need to know now.
We will not be covering season 7.
No, this is the last podcast.
How big of a dick move
would
that be?
It would be on the Draper scale for sure.
Yeah.
But how is this the last cast of season 6? I got to know now because it's going to change how I cover the episode.
It is not.
Okay.
We're going to do a recap episode of the season next week.
Okay, good. Because I've got a lot to say about the overall themes
and
how it's kind of come
us.
Together and where what you know where we're going beyond this.
For sure.
At least 30 minutes of material.
Okay, I have
so
at least
cool.
40 seconds of material on that. So 30-minute, 40-second podcast next week, guys.
You always say that, and then we end up talking for an hour and a half.
I just haven't thought about it yet, so we'll get there next week. Okay. But for now, we need to start with the recap of this episode. We have now blathered for 5 minutes about absolutely nothing. All right, so we start off with Don being greeted by Stan when he arrives in the office, and Stan asks him, hey, can I move to California on the Sunkist account so he can build an office out there.
Yeah.
Take it from a desk to a company.
Yeah. And he's all suited up and well-groomed.
Well-groomed. Speaking of which, you were giving him mad props for the beard.
Yeah, man. It's like, I give him mad props for growing out those, like, the little wispy whiskers that you get on the tops of your cheeks. I get that. But I don't have the balls to grow them out because it looks so hobo scummy while it's happening.
Yeah.
But when you see a man with a magnificent... I mean, it's trimmed, but he doesn't shave his neck. He doesn't shave his cheeks. It's just all there. And that giant mustache that envelops the whole thing and frames it. I got a little beard envy of Stan.
Yeah, you're getting a simmy over there with your beard.
Certainly jealous beard of the love. Man's hair. I mean, he's just got a giant Sasquatch head. Not like head, like most people refer to scalp. His entire face and head is encased in hair.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Imagine the rest of him. Ugh. Speaking of the rest of him, Stan's got
now
a little bit of a gut going on.
What?
Stan's got a little bit of a gut going on, and the pants of the 60s are not helping him out, man. They are tight pants.
He has a very tailored suit. I did not notice the gut.
Oh, it may not have been here. It's when he's in the red shirt and the tan pants. The tan pants are always a bad idea. Always a bad idea. Anyway.
At least he's not wearing toe sandals.
Yeah, so this is... Don kind of gets the spark of an idea here that he's later going to claim as his own for moving to California. And then we go over to Roger, who apparently has denied money to Brooks.
Yeah.
Right? For his refrigeration investment. And his daughter is very angry about it.
Yeah. Well, did you notice that, like, the picture she handed of Roger is literally Roger wearing a queen gown with a crown holding giant bags of money?
What?
You didn't notice
that? What are you talking
that?
About this picture? I don't even notice a picture.
Oh, for Christ's sake. Yeah, she hands him a crayon-drawn picture, and he's like,
okay,
you got my good side. But it's him standing in this purple gown with a gold crown, and he's got these giant bags of money in both hands.
What has she told his granddaughter about him?
Grandson, you mean?
Or grandson, yeah, about him.
So did you catch my complete inability to pronounce and get gender switched and... Because that's what I'm famous for. We can't both be doing it.
Well, I've also caught a little bit of scotch here. So.
Oh, that's true. And also, a kid's name's Ellery.
Ellery, yes.
You're going to maybe make that mistake, Margaret.
Yeah. Celery.
No, but yeah, what the hell is she?
Is apparently being fed a bunch of lines by her mother.
Yeah, like Grandpa Money Bags. Hubba, 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 money, money, money.
Yeah, which that fits with the relationship we've seen, you know?
It's still... really gross.
It's horrible. And also, why is she so ungrateful?
Because it works. I mean, look at Roger. That was scored. Instead of being like, you know
so
what, you're a grateful bitch, I'm giving you nothing more. You know?
As he has the right to say, because he's already helped him, and Brooks has failed and lost his money for him.
Yeah.
And now they want more?
Yeah, that's the other.
And she gets angry when he won't give them any more money to lose? What?
Yeah. I mean, it's uncomfortable and it's gross, but it's what Roger has cultivated over
clearly,
a lifetime of disappointing. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, I can't condemn Margaret too much because I can imagine that he's had a lifetime of disappointing her and buying his way out of it.
Certainly, but it also betrays her real reason for being there. She didn't bring that picture to him because she wants
She's a dog that's been well-trained. I mean, it's sure. like if you get an attack dog and he viciously assaults the mailman because you weren't paying attention, can you be mad at the dog?
No, I guess not.
So I just feel like that's, you know.
Speaking of people who have been viciously attacked, Ken and Jim show up and tell Don that they've got a meeting with Hershey's and that they want him in on it, and he accepts. He takes the Hershey's account. Was there any inkling in this scene of Don kind of recognizing, oh, this is something from my childhood that's very near to me?
Obviously, the first time I watched it, I didn't think anything of it. But the second time and third time, I did notice a little twinkle of his eye when he said, I love Hershey's. Get me in that room.
Yeah.
I think he does have an I mean, the second story he told was genuine, heartfelt. Like you said, it's, you know.
Yeah, you don't make that story up.
And it said sweet on the package. It's the only sweet thing in my life. I truly feel like that's a dead-on assessment of his emotional connection to the company. And I do think that, obviously, Wiener's smart enough to have him portray that, and Don's and John Hamm skillful enough to do it. So I did see it on his face on subsequent watches.
Okay. Yeah, that's why I asked, because I did too. Wanted to make sure I wasn't crazy. Speaking of people in the office, crazy people in the office, Pete apparently loves Chevy because he tells Roger as much on the stairs when they meet and they're passing.
I love Roger faking interest in Pete.
Right, as he looks over his shoulder to see Joan and Bob kind of mingling. And then he goes over to say hello.
Mm-hmm.
It's
all fun and games to get shot in the face, Jim.
Yeah. You think he wants Bob to get shot in the face? Maybe just a little bit. Yeah.
Mm.
Pretty sure. So that kind of sets up.
I thought it was later. An ejaculation reference.
Oh, God.
I'm not sure if it was directed to Joan or Bob, though, is the problem.
Moving on. Megan gives Don a letter from the DA concerning Sally.
Which, by the way, We've opened up on Don in two separate scenes of him drinking.
Yeah.
Like, he was pouring the whiskey into the coffee. He's now pouring something else into something else. He's basically drunk morning, noon, and night, apparently, from what we can see in this episode.
Yes. Some mornings more than others, but we'll get to that. We find out that Sally's middle name is Beth, obviously named after her mother, Betty.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only interesting thing in that scene, I think, other than him drinking.
And the name game.
The name game, in care of?
Yeah.
Was that written
was
on the envelope?
In care, it's CO Mr. Donald Draper.
Okay. Gotcha.
There you go, in care of.
Good stuff. We could play the name game a little more.
All right. I thought
Roger's kid is in care of Joan, or in care of Bob. At the moment.
And transitioning to Roger, the telegram that Pete got was care of SCMP.
Uh-huh.
Actually, I think, I didn't write down. I wrote down everything else on the damn thing except for who it was addressed to. But I thought it might have been addressed to the old name of the firm. But I don't know. I'm not going to stake my internet reputation of being constantly wrong on it.
Okay. So then Roger tells Bob to back off of Joan in a really good scene. He calls him into the office. And
I like how he instantly
summoned
him like fucking the Candyman. You know?
Doesn't he make a sarcastic comment to his secretary when she announces that he's there?
No, I think he makes it right to Bob. He's like, were you just circling outside?
Yeah. I noticed that Roger doesn't even have a desk in his office anymore.
Mm.
It's just a table with some Chinese checkers on it.
Yeah. Like,
that's it.
He's transitioning into Burt Cooper mode. Next year, it's just going to be Japanese pornography and and bare feet.
So you go, so what is the progression? Desk, Chinese checkers, Japanese pornography.
Yeah.
Tentacle porn.
Yeah.
All right.
You start with the Chinese checkers, then you move into Japanese tentacle porn.
Awesome.
You move down the line of Asian pastimes.
Don calls Sally to tell her that she has to give a statement about the burglar because, you know, that's the law. And then he gets a zinger off the back end of this conversation.
Hell yeah, he does.
Wow, I couldn't believe it. She's just like, well, I wouldn't want to do anything immoral. Why don't you just tell them what I saw?
Boom.
Boom. Because obviously he told her what she saw.
That's so channeling Betty, too.
Oh, yeah.
The whole, you know, seize the moral high ground, cut off your avenue of escape, and then put the spear directly in your gut. Also, she's also mastered the Betty art of dropping the mic when it's time to hang up. It's like, no goodbye, just click.
I think that's just a Draper trait. I think all the Drapers can do that. Drop of a hat.
No, Don says goodbye. His thing is he answers the phone with what?
Okay. So Sheridan shows up, and Jim can't find Don anywhere. Apparently, he's gone to the bar. He's drinking away his troubles, and he catches the attention of a priest who begins, or a minister who begins preaching to him. And he takes offense with it.
What kind of asshole hangs out of bars haranguing the drunks?
Well, what kind of asshole doesn't throw that asshole out of his bar?
You're scaring off all his customers. Exactly.
That's the first thing I thought. Get him out of here. He's killing your profits, man.
It's like my buddy Josh used to work at a bar, and he said there used to be a cop that pulled in the parking lot and like was do his paperwork because it was convenient. And like they had to go out and tell him, like, we appreciate what you're doing, but you're killing our business because all of our regulars don't come in when you're sitting in a parking lot.
Yeah.
So
wait to bust people when they come out drunk.
Yeah, all right. I mean, these guys are just trying to drink themselves to death in peace. Why can't you respect that?
Sure. As long as they don't drink themselves to death on the road.
Mm.
That's fine. There's a song here that's playing called Band of Gold that I think we actually have an email about this as well.
Yep, we sure do.
It was playing in the very first scene of the pilot. So that is a long gone callback.
Did you get that on the first?
I did not. No, I had to read Seppenwald's review.
I was listening to Seppenwald's podcast this morning when he mentioned it. Neither him nor Dan got it, but a lot of alert listeners did. And I'm just amazed.
Well, it's freaks who are. Well, it's no. Honestly, it's people who happen to be watching something. Like watching back episodes while this episode is airing.
Right.
Or have watched them recently.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing is, like, if you've got thousands of people, you know, following you like Seppenwald does, and not to be too modest, but we do too.
What?
There's, you know,
I thought my mom was the only one listening.
Their odds are great that you're going to have somebody that has just happened to watch the first season or just got done marathon on Netflix and is able to make that connection.
Yeah, because I certainly don't remember all that
stuff. Also, you got people with just freakish memories. So
true.
There's always that, too.
So we go to a flashback here real quick after a great line from Don. What the hell did you say?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think this is really effective storytelling. And it's one of the – a lot of people get annoyed at flashbacks. I kind of – in general, I'm in for flashbacks, but they were a little bit heavy-handed this year. This is a great effective flashback. It basically took the place of a fight scene with the minister. And very short in media res, got in, got out, woke up at a drunk tank.
And we get to see how Don reacts, if not necessarily him reacting, but also at the same time, why he reacts that way.
Yeah.
Like it is very effective storytelling. Got a little bit of mush mouth here.
Yeah. Well, what the fuck? Someone is going to sit there and tell you that Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and every boy dying in Vietnam are not true Christians?
What kind
of religion is that?
That's Christianity, man. No. I don't want to get religious up in here because everyone has different opinions on that and very strong opinions, and I don't want to offend anyone.
Well, but if your opinion is none of those people are true Christians, you're wrong. And probably stop listening to our podcast.
Well, they did. They just shut it off. We're going to get a lot of angry emails.
Good.
And we're going to move on to the next scene as well. No. Let's not move on to the next scene because this flashback at the very end, this guy who's trying to preach to all the whores says the only unpardonable sin is to believe God cannot forgive you. That's not true, man. I've read the Bible. I know that the only unforgivable sin is to speak against the Holy Spirit, to blaspheme.
What the fuck? Yeah. I thought you didn't want to get into religion, man.
I'm just calling this guy out. Okay. You're totally wrong, dude. I don't want to like discuss it. I'm just saying.
Yeah, all right.
But we should talk about how that affected Don, right?
I also think it's funny that Don punched out a guy for doing the exact same thing that this dude that had a very formative opinion on. You know, he's basically going to a whorehouse preaching.
Uh-huh, exactly.
You know, and his Uncle Mel or whatever his name. Do you remember?
I think
his
it's
name?
Mac, but I'm not
Uncle
sure.
Uncle Mac. His reaction is exactly what we thought the bartender should have done, mm-hmm. which is throw this guy out.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a time
what
and place
that say
for
about us. Well, oh boy!
No, I think people know exactly our deal, and how ill suited we are to interact with humanity on the whole,
or
so.
Getting interrupted in bars when we're just trying to drink.
We're just trying to drink. That's why we drink in the privacy of our own home.
There,
not to worry about getting on the road. We just drink up, get on the podcast, have some fun. We sleep it off. We don't end
For
up
sure.
in, we don't end up in Rikers.
We just end up publicly humiliated.
Everyone wins.
All right. So Don wakes up in jail, and we find out that he punched the minister, and then he sleeps it off. He says, I shouldn't be here, which I agree for a different reason than you probably would think. He shouldn't be there because it's fucking up his life.
Mm.
But he does belong there at this current moment.
Yes.
He's way too drunk.
I just love the drunk tank scene, man, because these guys are just sleeping in all kinds of weird, relaxed positions on top
Even
of each Don, other.
Don with his leg up in the air?
Yeah,
like,
man.
How do you sleep like that?
I don't know.
You got to be drunk.
Super drunk.
Yep. Then we go over to Ted and his family in the office, and they stroll past Peggy on their way out to the movies. And Peggy apparently takes offense to this because we find out later that she's not happy with the little look she got from his wife.
Did you think there was anything to that look?
No.
I don't think so either.
She's getting paranoid like...
Yes.
Ted was getting paranoid.
But it's funny because, like, on our live Facebook thread, which was awesome as always, a lot of people were like, I guess it's the power of suggestion, because I saw that, didn't think anything of it, rewound that scene a bunch of times to try to see if I saw anything. But,
yeah.
You know, like, she might, obviously she's a little bit jealous because she's called out in a couple episodes ago about, you know, I'm sure you enjoy being up in your plane with your, you know, pretty young copywriter, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But I don't think Ted's given her any reason to be jealous.
I agree. Yeah. Other than working late nights. Which,
and fucking Peggy.
Well,
other than those things.
She doesn't know that. And that hasn't happened yet.
Spoiler. Spoiler alert.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I don't think there was anything.
I saw no evidence of it.
Okay.
So
it's a good thing she wasn't wearing her date night outfit at that point. Oh, man.
That might have, you know.
So Pete's leaving when he gets a telegraph, a very random telegraph that says his mother fell off a freaking ship, lost at sea.
Deepest condolences. We now wash our hands of this matter, SS Sunset Princess.
So
which was going to be my new nickname for Pete. If like Pete's mom comes back, washes off the bridge, show her and comes back next season, that's her nickname. She's the Sunset Princess.
Okay.
Do you think anyone would buy a t-shirt of her face?
Sunset Princess?
Like her face and just in a really nice scripted font, Sunset Princess.
Maybe
her and Manolo together.
Maybe a fake cruise line called Sunset Princess or a cruise liner. Maybe, I don't know. Anyway, so this is the point where I was like, uh-oh. I didn't like this. I felt like this was totally random and like Tom and Lorenzo said, kind of a plot line that doesn't belong in Mad Men. Or when you hear it, you don't think, yeah, that makes sense in Mad Men. Right? Like,
mm-hmm.
Character's mother pushed off a ship by a gay gigolo.
Yeah. Well, and I actually thought Tom and Lorenzo were going to ride hard against that. You know, like, what is this bullshit? But they were all basically, well, it's kind of, their point was, it was... did I or did I not read that they said that it was a historical fact that they had a certain class of gay gigolo drifter that went around and bilked old ladies out of their money?
Yes, exactly. Exactly right.
And Manolo, I guess, is a murderer on top of that? So
I'm not convinced of that yet. Pete is certainly convinced of it. I'm not.
All right. Did you think, okay, so how much, well, let's wait till we get to the Bob Benson. And it's,
okay.
I'm not sure. Great Bob plot before we get into that. Cause I've got some stuff that I want to, some questions I want to propose to you.
Okay. But the point I was trying to make, I guess, is this is the kind of the area where it gets a 9 for me. It's this plot line. And also I felt like the beginning of this was very, very rushed. It didn't feel like some of the other stuff I've seen in Mad Men. And it had some weird jumps in time, like with the prison scene, which not as weird as that scene with the heart attack in the lobby of Don's apartment
building. I don't know. That seemed... Yeah, you say it had weird pacing, but did it feel rushed to you?
Yes. I thought it was... Yes, the first time I watched it, it felt very rushed. Hmm. On second viewings, it didn't feel as rushed, so I'm not taking points off for that. I'm just taking the point off from the Manolo stuff.
Hmm. See, when I first talked to you about it, like right after we saw it, I got the opinion that you thought the first half of the episode was slow-paced.
Oh, no, no. The opposite. I expect slow from Mad Men.
Because the last half of the episode is breakneck, but again, I thought the pacing was fine. It wasn't a problem. It was just exhilarating.
Sure. There were more reflective moments in the second half of this.
Okay.
I feel like, and maybe that's, you know, by design, you take the first half of the episode and you just build up these moments that are coming and going to land a little harder in the second half of the episode.
Hmm.
I don't know. Anyway, Don's pouring all his alcohol down the drain when Megan wakes up, and he tells her that he spent the night in jail and that he wants to move to California, and Megan agrees they should go.
So people give Jessica Parry a lot of shit.
Do they?
I thought, for being... I mean, I don't think she's a great actress on the Elizabeth Moss level.
Okay.
But she is certainly capable, and she does everything that's required of her. I mean, did you not believe her, like, almost desperate, joyous, crying reaction to Don saying he's drying out and I'm taking you to California where you can excel at your job?
I totally bought it.
No, I thought it was great. I mean, what more do we want for Megan? Like, or Jessica, for that matter.
I mean, she hasn't been given a lot of great stuff to do these last few episodes, right?
Yeah,
she's just been kind of in the shadow of Don, hoping that things don't go too south.
Like, I do believe that that January Jones has a very limited range. When she's playing the Ice Queen, she's brilliant. When she's playing, you know, kind of like the almost wise mother figure to the Don, she's really good. If she's doing anything other than that, she drives me crazy, which maybe that's the point. But yeah, I don't understand the hate on Megan, that because I even Steppenwall and Feinberg on their podcast were going on about and about how they hope that Megan doesn't come next year.
Wow.
That if she makes an occasion, like one guest star, maybe be okay, but they don't need to see any more Megan. I'm like, I don't know.
People were saying the same thing about Sylvia this season, though
rightfully so.
Even though, I mean, Linda Cardellini is fantastic.
Sure.
Throughout it. So, I mean, maybe I feel like the way that they left it, and we'll probably talk about this more next week, but the way that they left it, you can't just shut the door on Megan unless you just want to imply that during that year that things have, you know, tapered off with them.
It's basically like what we speculated would happen between season 4 and 5.
Yes.
Which is like,
she would just be
we
gone.
Just come back and they'd be gone, and, you know, we wouldn't hear until like episode 5. Like, what happened to Megan? Oh, yeah, I got that shit annulled. As soon as I got back, I lost my mind. I don't know what's going on.
I pushed her off a cruise ship.
We were happy in the Caribbean.
I think it's kind of sad in this scene that Megan thinks this is a step forward for the relationship, and really this is just Don running away.
Yes, but and the flashing red light should have been the fact that he hadn't even thought of his kids.
Yeah.
Like, she's like, what about the kids? Yeah. And he's like, they'll trade a weekends for a whole summer in L.A. I just heard you say what a hellhole L.A. was, an undomesticated bullshit. It's Detroit with palm trees, and your kids are going to want to spend their summers there?
Yeah. You're absolutely right.
Are you going to take all summer off from work, Don? I mean, why would you? He just... Yeah. Like,
why doesn't she pick up on that? Is she just so happy to hear him change his tune on it?
I mean, Megan desperately loves Don Draper.
Yeah, unfortunately.
And, you know, she's probably his first really serious relationship. They got married. She's attached to the kids. She's scared to death is drinking. She probably knows he's cheated on her. And now he's basically, you know, had this moment of clarity, pouring out the booze, and she doesn't want to hear anything but that, clinging on to that hope, you know?
Yeah, no, I'm with you. Let's move on. Don informs the partners of his plans to move to California, and Ted doesn't like that Don doesn't need to vote to actually do whatever he wants.
Yeah, and pay attention to the framing of this shot, too. It's basically behind Don's head looking out over the table. So you see Don, the back of Don's head looming large and all the partners, you know, kind of faded out into the distance as he's announcing that I'm going to California.
Because Don is Don.
Because Don is Don, but they're going to flip that later on in the episode.
Yes, they do. And they flip it to good effect. And can I just say up front, I love the lighting in that scene.
Mm-hmm.
When they, not in this scene, in the scene where they give him his leave of absence. Fantastic lighting.
I've said it before, the lighting has been very Godfather-ian this season. And, you know, lots of lights and darks and playing the contrast and just, it's, mm-hmm. like I said, it's not a soft light. It's just a particular, very movie quality lighting that I always associate with, you know, the first Godfather.
Yeah. But we will get there. So Stan gives Don some shit about stealing his position in California. Doesn't like it one bit. I think this is the scene where his tan pants betray his gut. But I don't know.
And he also, this is, so these are all, you know, basically smacking Don in the face with how insensitive and what a shit he's been.
Yeah, so first he confronts him about his secretary, right?
Yeah.
So he walks in while Don is making a call to his secretary to get him
not
something.
There because, yep. And Stan's implication is, why should she be here? Because she knows you're a short-timer.
Yeah, and the fact that Don didn't even consider anybody else.
Yeah, it's like she drafted the letter and you didn't even think about what impact it would have on her,
yeah.
if any.
Yeah, and that's Don. That is classic Don.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to get himself out of problems, not giving a shit about what it does to anybody else.
Also,
and destroying everybody else around him in the process. I mean, what does Don do now? Don.
And the last three seasons, Don has basically taken credit for his underling's work. I mean, Peggy felt like he basically stole the Clio from her.
Yep.
For the furniture, no, it was a floor polish campaign.
And then he
season five,
took
he
it away from her
outright
again.
Stole Ginsburg's idea.
Well, yeah.
In a client pitch, and then this year he steals Stan's. And it's really tragic for Stan because that was like his future, that you can clearly see that he's invested in a way. He probably hasn't invested in something in a long time.
Oh, yeah, except growing a beard. He's
and
fully
smoking,
invested.
And smoking weed at work.
Yeah. Actually, I get the impression that he has kind of tapered back on that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I feel like if he goes to Don and he says... because of the conversation he had with Don at the very beginning, where you don't see me like that, but you're going to start to.
Seeing Pete smoke weed, he's like, man, this isn't cool anymore.
This used to be cool.
This is bullshit. You've ruined weed. Herb for me, Campbell.
He's a weed hipster.
I smoke in doobies before it was cool.
I love the idea that he goes home and just thinks, what does what
like
does it
Don
say about
doing
me?
His booze? He's just throwing it all down the garbage disposal.
With a picture of Pete on the wall.
Just bales and trees going down the garbage disposal, clogging his sink.
I love that he's using a garbage disposal.
Oh, of course.
Down his sink?
Yeah. Okay. It doesn't go down as well as booze, man.
Well, most people flush it, right? That's what you do with drugs when you're,
I wouldn't
when
know,
you're getting
Jim.
Rid of them. That's what I hear. I've seen a lot of movies, man. A lot of movies. Anyway, Pete finds out that Manolo and his mother were married before she was killed. Bob's waiting for him, so he rushes out the door. And in the elevator, he accuses Bob of being an accessory to murder in a fantastic scene.
Oh, Pete's on fire this episode. We've glossed over this. You know, when everybody's kind of like, Jesus Christ, Don's going to L.A., he's like, honestly, I have bigger problems than this.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's just having
this... He
doesn't
give a shit.
He's just having this fit. Like, you know, he married her? You tell that, you know, it's like, put him on house arrest, or ship arrest, the brig, whatever. I was imagining the other side of his conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty effective with Pete on the phone there.
Although it is kind of amazing, I kind of feel his outrage that all these, you know, I guess Caribbean governments... and the ship and the cruise line itself are denying any kind of responsibility or any interest at all in resolving it. Like, they basically said that the cruise line considered the matter resolved when they sent that telegram. Like, hey, we let you know.
Well, they probably lose
courtesy.
People all the time, right?
No.
You got to imagine people just going over. You get people drunk on a cruise ship and
this
somebody's
isn't the
North going
Atlantic,
over.
Man.
Oh, yeah. Iceberg right ahead.
Anyway. No, I don't think that that's true at all.
you're probably right about that.
I would think there would be a cash. Like nowadays, they'd send a cash settlement along with the telegram.
Oh, would they?
Oh, they'd have to just to make it go away.
Maybe. You're probably right. I mean, certainly when – I don't know that they'd mention it until –
It would basically be a cash offer with, hey, sign this to receive it and also acknowledge that you have no right further rights and we are, you know, responsible and here's 50 grand. You know, it's like I think that's exactly how it
50 grand for your mother? That's pretty cheap.
Well, it's Pete's mom.
Well, yeah, true. I mean, he's not willing to spend
it. It's on
money.
A sliding scale and it's basically the only rung lower is Don Draper's stepmom. Or Dick Whitman's stepmom, so, yeah.
What else was I going to say about this scene? Because there are a couple of... So, first of all, do you think Manolo's guilty? Do you think...
Man.
...the Manolo married his mother and pushed her overboard to collect money that he thought was there?
So, you're wanting to dispute all facts. Did Manolo marry his mother? I mean, unless the cruise ship people
Manolo
are lying.
Yes, Manolo married his mother. I don't think the cruise ship people would lie about that.
Okay.
I don't think they can lie about that. That's probably on record.
Now, did he push her off the ship, or did he get her off at port and just come back on and think that her addled brain... I mean, she couldn't get herself home to her own goddamn apartment in New York City unless Manolo wrote her address on a card that she could give to the taxi driver.
Yeah.
So, did Manolo kill her... Or did Manolo just drop her off at port and, you know, maybe she's... That's the thing. It's like, we know she's dead?
Like, fuck, she's crazy. I don't want to deal with her and drop her off?
No, just intentionally. Like, I'm going to wander through these, you know, streets of this island. And then as I'm going to, when she turns her back, leave. And she'll never be heard of again.
Oh, so you're saying that Manolo is a grifter.
Yeah, him being the killer is what I'm having trouble with. Now,
I mean, there's also a dispute that he's even a grifter, that he's even after her money. Like, maybe she went overboard. Maybe he lost track of her and she went overboard.
Why else would he marry her? He's a gay. He's. Do you not believe that Bob Benson would know if he's gay or not?
That's a fair point.
I mean...
Yeah, so that's pretty convincing.
And the other thing is, what part did Bob have to play in this? I mean,
honestly, looking at him in that elevator, I don't think he had any part in it. Bob, I know who Bob is.
He's a practiced liar.
I know. But his reaction felt very honest there. He didn't have that stupid smile on his face.
That's what the ER nurse said when he told her that Joan drank furniture polish, too. So, you know, this guy's very earnest and honest and well-meaning.
He got me.
The thing is the only kind of... random thing is just like last week. What the hell was he having this angry conversation with Manolo in Spanish about?
Yeah.
You know, dealing with Pete Campbell. I mean, and we thought it was kind of a lame response, her going to get her passport. I mean, what the hell? What is that all about?
Yeah, so we thought that conversation was just him basically yelling at Manolo saying, stay away from her. Like, this Pete guy, that's what I thought.
Yeah, I don't...
This Pete guy is my boss. Don't fuck with him. Stay away from his mother.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's we don't know enough information to say either way.
I agree. And I don't see us getting any big resolution to this either.
It would have to come from Pete or his brother and
following up. They're not apparently going to.
Yeah.
It costs a little too much money.
Yeah.
For them to care.
Right. I mean, so.
But also the logistics of it as far as like the filming of the series goes, like. Next year, potentially, we're going to be back a year from now. Are they even going to bother to resolve something like this a year after it happens?
I would say we've got more chance of finding, you know, Nicole Brown Simpson's real killers than we do of Pete and Bud getting to the bottom of their mother's...
Holy shit, that happened a long time ago.
Yeah, her mother's murder mystery, you know? There's
sure,
no way.
Okay.
Crocodile tears all around.
Yeah, I'm with you. So that brings absolutely no closure to the Manolo story, but
I can see that costing you the episode a point.
Yeah, yeah. It didn't feel like it was necessary at all. But,
tough but fair.
It was certainly necessary to get Bob to say, "Hey, I need to really get this guy off my back," which we'll see in a couple scenes here. But first, Peggy gets dolled up to go out on a date, and then decides to stop by Ted's meeting first. To flaunt her goods, her wares.
Yeah.
I gotta say, va va voom, Peggy, looking pretty good.
Yeah.
In that It almost felt like a 70s style dress. I mean, this is very into the 60s for sure, but felt very modern, very
yes, it
chic.
Did. And then also, like, a lot of, like, Megan's shit I don't find sexy, because I remember even saying that. It's like, this is what you... When your mother tells you to dress up sexy, you decide to basically go as David Bowie in drag. but this was sexy as hell. This was warm to the touch.
And I got to say, I don't particularly think that Elizabeth Moss is attractive.
Oh, go fuck yourself.
I think anybody who does is crazy, but...
Well, sign me up for the mental asylum. I think she's totally hot.
Why?
She's
Why?
Cute. She's
cute.
Not cute.
She's completely uncute.
She's cute. She's got a nice body. She's smart. The only thing that...
I agree with all those.
The only
nice
thing that keeps me
smart,
going from
definitely.
Full-blown crush mode is the fact that I know she's a Scientologist.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So is Fred Armistead. You want to blow your mind with that? Totally recontextualize your feelings on these celebrities.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, so obviously she knows what she's doing. She walks in there. She says hi to Ted and walks out with a little look back, make sure Ted's watching her walk away, and heads out.
Yeah, she did. That was a really good shot of her, you know, her confidence when, you know, they got in tight on her face as she's shutting the door.
Yeah.
She knows the hook just got set.
I like Jim's reaction in this scene, too. Because he's, you know, he's a bit of a player. He's like a Roger, and he's kind of on the hook here, too.
He was in a much classier way than Harry doing, you know.
Classier than Harry? Come on.
Yeah, I know. I know. It you have to dig deep to get classier. I thought that was also funny. Like, he's, you know, like, yes, he definitely was visibly moved by her youth and beauty. But then when Harry's like Vixen by Night, you could kind of see him like shudder, like kind of like straight up his papers, like, Jesus Christ, this crane guy.
Yeah.
Keep your tongue in your mouth, fellow.
For sure. So then we go to Detroit, where in the lobby of the GM building, Bob decides to make a fool of Pete by forcing him to drive a Camaro. And Pete promptly crashes it into the GM anniversary sign, revealing that he can't drive a stick.
So my first reaction is, Jesus Christ, Pete, why did you go to war with Bob just after? I mean, did you learn nothing
from
last
week? Well, he killed his
week?
Mother, potentially, right?
So
there's that.
My first reaction is that, but then my second, third reaction is, you would get kind of emotional about
a little bit,
you know?
Yeah.
But still.
I get that. And I understand the role that Pete's mother's plotline serves in this episode. I just feel like it's a little over the top.
I just think that it's awesome how Bob destroyed Pete by handing him a set of car keys.
Yeah.
That
now, how do you think Bob knew he couldn't drive?
Because
he hasn't been around long enough to understand that he just took his test like a year ago.
Yeah, obviously, he's taken a personal interest in him, and he's soaked up a lot of stuff that he's... I mean, it's got to have been.
You think?
Him glad-handing and getting information, observing the fact that... Yeah, I mean, I maybe it's something they talked about, like, because they've been planning on going up to this Detroit for... And they've been doing this for a month now. Maybe it's something that Pete's confided in him. I didn't have a problem with the fact that he knew.
I didn't either.
That Bob knows exactly the pressure point to apply. And it's kind of scary.
Yeah.
Like I said, he just completely immolated that guy by handing him a set of car keys.
Yeah. So last episode, we weren't really on board with the Bob is a mastermind scenario. Here it felt like he was more of a mastermind.
Well,
right?
I think he's just natural talent, and what little hand Pete had in that relationship was the fact that Bob is inexperienced and was scared at that leverage.
Yeah.
He didn't know that most of the partner's reaction would be like, "Who gives a shit?" And Pete did. So when he was sufficiently desperate. I mean, Pete is basically accusing him of being an accomplice of murder. And still, it took Pete freezing him out of the account. He's like, oh, yeah, he's not going to be going to dinner with us tonight.
Yeah.
Before Bob kind of, you know, decided, like, what the hell else do I got to lose? I can see where this is going. And he just casually destroyed Pete's career. I mean, he's been working hard on it all season long, losing Vix, over a petty argument with his stepdad, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, yeah. You know, Pete has thrown away everything that's been given to him and everything he's worked for.
Although that's technically, I think Vix was lost as soon as he showed up at that whorehouse.
Yeah, no, but that is, but I mean, that is Pete's resolution in this episode, right?
Yeah, he threw away his entire career, family, everything in this season.
Yeah, for nothing.
For nothing. For a shop. I mean, I don't know. Going to L.A. might be good for him.
Maybe. Well, we'll get to that. I also thought it was interesting how Bob not only knows Pete's weak point, but he also understands the GM guys as well, because he knows what happened with Ken and what type of clients they were, and that Pete not being able to drive that stick is going to be the last straw for him, right? They're high testosterone guys who...
So
Pete crashes a sign and can't drive a stick, forget about it.
So fun fact, you cannot drive a stick either.
I can't, not at all.
Did this steal your resolve to learn how to drive a stick? The fact that you are small way like Pete Campbell?
I've got all my hair. I don't need a stick, man. As soon as I start shaving back my hair, I'll have to learn a stick, but
I'm just saying, that could be you one day.
No, I want to, man, but you can't rent a stick, and I don't want to destroy my brother's new car. So.
What the fuck, dude?
I'm going to burn the clutch
out
of any car I try.
How long have you played video games? It's so, like, I never, that's the one thing I thought was unbelievable. I understand the guy just learned how to drive last year, but Jesus Christ, as a teenager, I picked up a stick like that.
Like, yeah,
I can see.
I'm sure
I can see killing it or stalling it out, but flooring it in reverse, and I mean, it just was a little.
Oh no, what Pete does there is crazy. Yeah. I would never do that. I'm talking about messing up his clutch.
You're not going to mess up his clutch.
Who knows, man? Who knows?
Your brother's got a shitty car. If that's the case,
he's got one of those Fiats, those fancy.
Oh yeah, that A
bars
or clutch
whatever it is.
Explode if you touched it.
It's an Italian clutch. It would revolt or something. I don't know. Anyway, so Ted's waiting for Peggy when she gets home, and he tells her that he's leaving his family, professes his love for her, and they end up in bed.
This was as unlikable as Ted has been this season.
What? Peggy certainly liked it.
Yeah, but this was incredibly selfish of him.
Oh, okay. Yes, yes, yes.
Basically, like, you know, I'm going to sample every piece of the Whitman chocolate sampler. And then
the Dick Whitman's,
like, you know,
chocolates. We should make those.
Yeah, we
Dick
should.
Dick Whitman's chocolate samplers. They're all shit.
We got a listener that sent an email. It was pretty funny about that. I hope it made the cut.
Oh, cool.
But anyway, yeah, it's like, you know, basically bit a piece of every piece of chocolate. And it's like, you know what? The mint julep chocolate's not for me. And well, we're going to get into that later.
What flavor is Peggy?
White chocolate raspberry. Nailed it.
Okay, that's good. Yeah, I like it.
Yep.
The hair, the dresses, sure.
Not your first choice, but then when you take a bite of it, you wonder why it wasn't.
Because it just looked so terrible. Anyway, moving on. Don gets a call in the middle of the night from Betty. Sally...
Also, did you notice Peggy has like 7 locks in her door? She only locks one lock.
Well, that's all she had time to lock, be fair.
Why does anyone have 7 locks on their door? It's like, your lock's either effective or it's not, man. Having
Plus,
7 shitty
Mythbusters
locks.
The Mythbusters totally busted that myth.
Really?
They could barely get through a deadbolt.
If it's a properly installed security deadbolt, you'd need some kind of battering ram to get through.
Yeah, you can't slam through that. I don't know, man. She lives in a very bad building, very bad side of town as well. Mm. So, I mean, that she lives with a bunch of junkies. I'd want to keep my stuff locked up, too. Anyway, Don gets a call in the middle of the night from Betty. Apparently, Sally has been suspended for buying beer, getting a bunch of girls drunk at school.
Which, and obviously, this hits home on multiple levels with Dick, because the whole broken home thing.
Yes,
the drinking thing. I mean, these are... He's basically seeing how he's creating... I think for the first time, has a self-awareness that he's created Sally in his image. In fact...
Yes.
Genesis of Dick Whitman's sexual dysfunction and general deviancy was seeing his stepmom get fucked by Uncle Mac through a keyhole.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly kind of what Sally did. She walked on him, saw him through the door.
Yeah,
and
with a set of keys in her hand, you know?
Yeah.
Like that. This is without a doubt, and I mean, I've watched The Inside Mad Men for this. Without a doubt, this is a realization moment for Don.
I thought it was hilarious that Sally would try to buy beer with a fake ID.
She looks
She's many things,
12 years
but
old.
She can't pull off
no
college kid. No way.
Not at all. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Don here is looking in the mirror and he's seeing what he's doing to his kids. I mean, it shows. I mean, he's got his head in his hands, literally there.
Mm.
You know?
Mm.
And this is just one of the many things that shakes him up enough in this episode to then have his Hershey confession later on.
Also, Betty just hangs up on him. She's done talking.
I'm done.
And I'm right out. Around here is like, so there's several rapid fire blows that shake him off of his path to LA.
Yeah.
This was one of them. And he even alludes to it when he tries to tell Megan. It's not just Sally. This is the first one.
Yep.
What do you think about when she says, I've done everything I can think of. The good is not beating the bad. She's talking about Sally, but this also works as a referendum on her motherhood, too. I mean, we've seen her do good things for Sally. The way she treated her after she became a woman.
Yes.
You know, was kind. A little self-serving there, but still kind. But we've also seen her publicly humiliating her for trying to masturbate and slapping her across the face and making her favorite punishment whenever she annoyed her was to send her to her room.
Or fire the maid.
Or fire, like, yeah, it's like...
She's done horrible
spite,
things.
Make her move away from her one friend that she had.
Yeah.
I mean... It works on multiple levels. The good of her is not outweighing the bad in Sally, but also the good that she got from her mom and dad are not outweighing the bad that she got.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. I think it works on very many levels, and that's one thing this show is good at.
Yeah.
If nothing else.
And it is her fault, and it's Don's fault.
Yes,
both of their
yes.
fault.
That broken home is not only created by Don, it's also created by
like
Betty.
Divorce is not the only thing that causes a broken home. That home was broken from the jump.
Yeah. You could argue that it was broken from Don's childhood.
Yeah, I mean, it's his fault. And also, her mom and dad were not saints either. I mean, didn't we...
I don't know much about them.
Well, I mean...
Have we learned
It was
lot?
My opinion, and we weren't doing a podcast, so my pre-podcast memory is a little fuzzy. But I remember when we used to have our epic discussions in our living room that we both were convinced that Gene molested
Betty,
if not all of his kids.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, I'd be interested to rewatch season 3 and 4.
Yeah, my brain will not go back there
yeah.
Without having seen the episodes again. So,
but yeah, so it's like but clearly there was some fucked up stuff, you know, with her relationship with her mother, if not her dad.
Yeah, definitely. Broken homes all around.
Mm-hmm.
We go back to another home that's
50s,
about to be broken
the good
up.
Good old days. Happy days.
Happy days? Yeah. Happy days for Ted and Peggy, basking in the afterglow of their raucous sex. I'm sure it was...
Planning a trip that will never be... This scene is super poignant the second and third time you watch it.
Yeah. Ted promises that they won't have to sneak around while he's still with his wife, but Peggy sends him home to avoid any drama.
It's kind of gross her being almost charmed by his lying philandering. Yeah, because she's all, like, you know, smiling and coy about, aren't you the one that always goes home, and I don't want a scandal, and, I mean, it never fails to amaze me, people that are cheating with a married person, they magically think that this will never happen to them.
Yeah, that's a good point. You've got to assume that the next Peggy that Ted finds, he's going to leave Peggy for.
Mm. Well,
you would think.
Even if he doesn't, why wouldn't you think that?
Yeah.
And why would you be like, you know, this kind of gleeful about, oh, yes, this is exactly how we will handle things to maximize our pleasure and minimize our discomfort. It's such a cold, calculating conversation to have.
Uh-huh. Which makes it all the worse when none of that comes true.
It's like I always marveled in The Wire, you know, when you're watching, like, low-level thugs planning the execution of even lower-level thugs. On behest of the upper level thugs. Like, doesn't that occur to them that they're going to be in that position one of these days?
Yeah. I think they just hope that they're going to be the lucky ones.
Yeah.
This is the last time this will happen, and I won't have to deal with it.
Yeah.
I guess. Anyway, so he goes home and he climbs in bed with his wife and she snuggles up and he has a moment of clarity. His mind has changed at that point.
Again, Mad Men women have no functional sense of smell because he should be coming home reeking of Chanel No. 5.
I think he took a shower at the end You hear some water go on. It might have been... Yeah, you hear some water go on at Peggy's house. I think he took a shower, which is the only reason, because I was wondering the same thing.
Okay. But well, that makes sense, because, again, they made a big deal of her. I mean, she smelled enough of it that Jim could get it from a couple feet away of her opening the door. So,
well, it's also Jim, you know. I'm sure he's been around.
He's got to finally... He's like Al Pacino in Scent of a Woman, man.
Oh, boy. I would do an Al Pacino impression, but it would be bad. Anyway, Pete returns from Detroit because he was fired from the account, from the Chevy account, and he asks his secretary to find him a place to live. Apparently, the Pete Pit, no more. There are tenants in the Pete Pit.
R.I.P. the Pete Pit.
Ooh. How would you like to be those people?
I don't know, man. I feel like it'd be like moving into Rosemary's Baby's apartment.
Gross.
Like, that's something that the realtor should have to declare. Like, you know, if someone got killed in the apartment, it's legally, you have to... Pete Campbell used to... Like, it was just for not even a full year.
Yeah.
But he, you know, he had sex with women here.
Yep. Lowers the market value by 10% at least.
His mother and a gay lover was involved in somehow. It's very sordid affair. And also Pete Campbell lived here.
Yeah. I didn't get that. Was Ken living in Detroit the entire time?
Because
Pete is moving to Detroit.
But he has nothing. I mean, Ken's in a different position. He has firm anchors. He loves his wife and his family. And I don't think he would do that. It was more of a commute type thing for him.
Okay.
Where Pete's like, fuck that. I'm going to go ahead. Why wouldn't he? Why wouldn't he?
Well, I thought Pete
like
had
Trudy
something
said,
else
at the
to
end,
do.
There's nothing holding you here.
Yeah. I just thought Pete had other business to attend to in New York.
Not as important as Detroit. Jesus Christ, they gave Bob a car. Did you get that?
They gave Bob a car?
Yeah.
I thought he just drove the Camaro.
No. Peg, when he gave that toy model to Kevin, Jones' son, and Roger came over there to kvetch about it, she was saying, yeah, they just gave Bob a real one.
Whoa. No, I didn't pick that up.
That's why it's such a hell of an account. I mean, we also see the downside, which is the guns and the violence and the casual disregard.
Getting shot in the face.
Yeah, getting caught shot in the face and apparently doing burnouts in the first floor of a corporate building.
Yeah.
I mean, we both had that conversation. It's like, what the hell were they suggesting that Pete do? Like, if you just drive around at 5 miles an hour inside in a building, you're not really getting the Camaro
experience.
Like,
also, there is a Corvette parked right in front of him.
Oh, really?
There's, like, a blue Corvette or whatever. At least last time they were in the office, there was. I didn't see it this time.
I feel like they were asking him to redline it, drop the clutch, and just do, like, a 100-yard burnout down that corridor, right?
There are people in that building.
Yeah.
Yeah, these guys are crazy.
They are insane.
It's our floor. We could do whatever we want. Kill people.
I never liked that wall. Just drive right through it, Pete. Show that rigid frame construction.
Pete, obviously, he's distraught at this point. He doesn't know what he's going to do. Tells his secretary to find him a new place to live.
Mm.
What if he doesn't like the place?
Mm. Come on. It's better. Can't it be worse than the Pete Pit?
I'm sure Pete loved the pit. I'm sure he loved it. Roger's secretary tells Joan that she's worried about Roger. In a kind of short scene here, so this is the scene that leads to Joan inviting him over for Thanksgiving, obviously. My bigger question, I guess, with this is, did Roger send his secretary over to Joan to say these things? Do you think Roger is trying to con his way back into the good graces of Joan so that he can see his daughter?
His daughter. That's an interesting thought.
I keep saying his daughter. His son?
Yeah, it's his son. Jesus Christ, Kevin.
Sorry.
I think that his secretary doesn't have that much guile.
She wouldn't have done it?
Yeah. She wouldn't have done it that well. I mean, it's very natural, and I also hilariously revealing about her life. About, I'd have him over, but Ralphie quit drinking, and little Ralphie's such a spaz. It's, you know,
well,
that wouldn't work.
Yeah, so it definitely says a lot about her, but it also says a lot about what she knows about Roger, because the fact that they quit drinking means Roger wouldn't be entertained there.
Yeah, oh, yeah. You know? Well, yeah. I mean, clearly she knows a lot about him. She's a secretary.
Yeah, no, I get it. I get it. The other question I have, is it possible that Roger could actually run out of money?
Oh, yeah, we've talked about this before.
Yeah.
He's so, basically halved and then quartered his existing wealth.
And then bought apartments, invested in businesses that have failed.
And yes, yes. Like, it would not shock me to realize, and it wouldn't shock me to realize that's the real reason he's starting to rein back a little bit on, you know, his son-in-law, that, like, maybe he's getting to the end of his financial ropes.
Yeah. I could see that. He's spent a lot of money lately.
Yeah. Although, what is his real living expenses? Everything he does for fun is on the company dime.
True.
He basically sport fucks cocktail waitresses and...
And not flight attendants.
Yeah, like, she was executive lounge attendants.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
That doesn't cost a lot of money.
True. I mean, he's got to take him out of dinner, right? He's got to wine and dine him first.
I bet he finds a way to expense that shit.
Probably. It's on the California trip.
I got a lot of receipts. I haven't figured it all out.
Exactly.
What's this thing from New York? What's this hotel room you rented in New York? It was related somehow.
Yeah. So Ted asks Don if he can take his place in California, and he says he needs to get away from Peggy so he can save his family, and Don refuses his request and crushes him, crushes the poor guy.
Yeah.
Speaking of pours, there was a generous pour at the end of this scene when Ted says you should have a drink before you go in there.
Well, John, yeah, he had cold turkey. He had the shaky hand.
He did. He did, but still, very generous pour, Don.
Also, Ted's trying to be kind, but that's like the worst thing you can tell an alcoholic. And Don, yeah,
just have one.
And John Hamm gave one of those epic alcoholics really like to drink performances. Like, oh, that's some good hooch, you know? I mean, this is like, just close the eyes, kind of like, you know.
Savor it. He savored it. Yeah.
Yeah. Like when Dracula licked the blood off of the razor, just like, you know, kind of reactions.
A Hannibal Lecter sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
That's the level of enjoyment we're talking about.
This is a great scene, right? I mean, of course, it's not as great as the next one, but it is, in its own right, a great scene from Chaw. I mean, the guy who plays him has a hell of a performance here, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Coming to Don... basically on his knees saying, I need this. And just the way he delivers that speech to me felt very earnest.
And then that 1,000-yard stare he had after he realized this isn't going to work. I'm fucked.
In that conference room. Yeah.
And then the fact that he showed real concern for Don. I mean, again, it's not the thing you want to tell an alcoholic, but still it's like, hey, you know, I want to ease into this because it's hurting you.
Speaking of showing real concern for Don, I mean, in this next scene with the Hershey's pitch, that's probably all I need to say to introduce that scene. He is lost in his thoughts throughout this entire meeting until Don begins his speech, and then he is rapt with attention on Don.
As we all are.
Yeah, absolutely. I just think it was interesting that Don's earnest confession here could pull Ted out of his own head here.
What was your reaction why this was happening? I was expecting something to happen. I was expecting him, because he had the whole like, oh God, this booze is so good.
Okay.
I was expecting him to, like, you know, vomit.
Just right on the table.
Like,
cover
did,
the table and
like
vomit.
He did at Roger's mom's funeral.
Uh-huh.
I was expecting him to do some kind of drunken boorish performance. I was not expecting the and then I've been saying for weeks that Don's been killing people with the truth.
Mm-hmm.
He killed me with the truth that night. I mean,
he killed the meeting with the truth, too.
I was like, oh my God. Oh my God. This is actually happening.
Yeah.
Did you get the sense that he was throwing his career away when he did this?
When you stack it up on top of everything else he's done.
Well, yes. And look at the reactions that John and Roger had.
Oh, yeah. Well, Jim and Roger?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Jim and Roger.
Yeah, Jim especially. I mean, Jim is just...
But even Roger was... The look on his face was not like, oh, my God, my poor friend. It was more like, what the fuck?
And Roger's reaction is more important in this scene because of their friendship, right?
Yeah. No, I mean...
the fact that this made Roger sit back and say, whoa.
Yeah.
This guy's really off the rails here.
Yeah.
That makes it his reaction very important. I honestly wasn't expecting it. I didn't know what I was expecting this episode, and I was trying to go into it without expectations, honestly.
Right.
I did expect at least to be blown away one time, and this scene definitely delivered.
Yeah, I remember because I tweeted you like halfway in. It's like, you know, how are you enjoying the episode so far? You're like, it's pretty good, but I'm still waiting for the cherry on top.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, how you like them cherries? So,
yeah. I said they were sweet as a Hershey bar.
Damn straight.
Because they were.
I mean,
what do we need to say about this scene?
First of all, the Emmys are bullshit. How many Emmys did The Wire win ever? Zero? Okay. Fucking award is bullshit. Having said that.
This performance deserves an Emmy.
Having said that.
A bullshit award.
Yes. Like, Bryan Cranston's got five of them now. Can we give Jon Hamm a goddamn Emmy?
Yes, please.
And honestly, I don't think this is his strongest performance. I think his strongest performance all season was the one he gave in the lobby where he conveyed wordlessly in 30 seconds the idea of a man that was completely lost and had no idea for the first time of his life what the fuck to do.
Yeah.
That's not easy to do.
This is also a fantastic one. I mean, when he says, when he delivers the line that it was the only sweet thing in my life, it's incredible.
Oh, and I lost it.
I do not lose it.
Yeah, yeah. You are a cyborg.
I am a cyborg. I am stoic. I about lost it because this is. In some ways, I identify with Don. I mean, I can admit to being a little broken myself. I think maybe all of us are a little bit. There's even a line in this episode that made me think of that. But I don't remember what it was at the time. Anyway, so to hit with a line like that, it really, you know, it hit me. It got to me.
Yeah, it's really tragic.
And it's the way he delivers it, too. It's
the reason he's done all this, the reason he has all this pathos is because he's scared to death of people realizing that Don Draper is a mirage, and he's really this Dick Whitman from this bullshit podunk town,
yes,
raised in a whorehouse. No one wanted him. No one loved him. And he is rejected by everyone after he comes clean.
I think that it's actually, I mean, he has now looked in the mirror. He has seen what he's done to the people around him. He's seen who is causing it. It's himself. And this is a moment where he says, I'm going to try to stop doing that. And this false idea that he comes up with his father taking him to the candy store and buying him a Hershey bar, that was too much bullshit. That crossed the line. He realized that he's perpetuating that cycle. He's going to try to do something different.
He looked across to Ted and saw that,
yes,
oh shit, what's going to happen to his kids? I see what happens to my kids.
Yeah.
And I can, you know, this, and it goes back to the Tale of Two Cities. This, I'm trying to save a lot of this for the end of season recap, but this is, you know, a far, far better thing that I've ever done. Like, he literally took Ted's place on the goddamn guillotine.
Yeah.
With his marriage and his family, to give him the chance to live a better life and to be the good man that he could have been.
Yeah.
It's
for sure.
Damn near heroic.
It is, even though I'm sure Megan would not view it that way.
Well, but that's why it's heroic.
That's why it's heroic?
I mean, him like, and there's a lot of readers that wrote in about this.
It's heroic because it costs him.
Were Megan and Don
ever... It's not heroic because it costs Megan.
No.
That's kind of an asshole move.
Yes, but Megan and Don, were they ever going to really work long term?
Who knows? California, it's 3,000 miles away, man.
I'm just saying the Tale of Two Cities parallels are
strong. I'm with you. And there's a line right after this that I bet you loved.
What's that?
Where Roger comes up to him in the hallway.
Oh, you shit the bed? Hell yeah, that's my line.
I know, you love that line.
I love the word shit. It's for my money, the funniest word in English language. Ape shit the bed, shit sandwich.
Yep. So we'll talk a little bit more about this
go blind.
At the end. God, we are running way long tonight, but it's worthy of a long
finale.
Podcast.
If you're going to do a 2-hour cast, you might as well do it on the finale.
Might as well. So Pete and his brother-in-law are talking with an official or a private detective.
And thank God for Pete Campbell for, if nothing else, comedic relief. This has been such a dark season.
Do you believe that Vincent Kartheiser does not play this for comedy at all? Do you believe that?
Dude, what have I been saying? Matt Weiner is a liar. And his legion of...
Well, Kartheiser has said it too.
I think he's either the stupidest man alive.
He's drinking the Kool-Aid.
Which I don't. I mean, he's one of those freegan type deals, so who knows. But he's either the dumbest man alive or he's bullshitting whoever's interviewing him. Because he's got to know when he falls and slips on his ass going down the stairs in a rage that that's hilarious. And that's not good, Bob. That's something out of a classic zany comedy, man.
It is. It is.
That's a comedic performance.
It's almost slapstick. Like, and it's borderline.
And this thing with him and his brother. So how much, hypothetically, ballpark... To bring your mother's killer to justice? Yeah. And then, like, they're back and forth about, you know, when you think about it, they won't bring her back. She's in the water with father. And Pete has this look where he's just like, loathe you, bud. I can't believe you're... Yeah, okay, I'm on board with this.
Yeah.
She
it
did
is going
to
cost
sea.
A lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, it's
she
like...
She love the sea.
It's brilliant and hilarious.
Yeah. Now, okay, so maybe... They certainly don't smile and laugh, and maybe they don't
that
play
would spoil
it
the joke.
For comedy, but it is written
it wouldn't
as
be fun-
comedy.
It wouldn't be funny if they did.
I totally agree. You need the straight man. You always need the straight man. In this case, everyone's a straight man, which is why a lot of the jokes work.
And the fact that as bad as we dislike Pete, his brother's probably that much worse. Because even
you think
Pete, Pete had the decency to feel bad and
well,
to be a little judgy.
Well, I think he only felt bad... because Bob Benson was involved, potentially.
No, I'm talking about...
I think he was angry for that.
I think he was disgusted with his brother before he realized, yeah, I can't get on that. It's not worth dying on that hill, you know? Like...
Really?
Just 4 or 5 weeks ago, Pete was desperate. He was willing to pay people to get rid of his mother.
That's what I'm
now
saying.
Now someone got rid of him her permanently for free.
That... So, yeah, actually, I had a little bit of a problem with that because before, like you said, he didn't want his mother around. Like, he apparently didn't speak to her ever. Why is he so concerned about this other than the fact that it was Bob Benson who may have been involved?
I mean, there's part of it and wanting to get
that's
back.
That's why
Manolo
I felt it was kind of weak as far as plot lines go.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, you're right. It is... But on the other hand, it also is one of the funnier things in this whole season.
Yeah.
So it's like, do you really want to debit Wiener's account for this?
Not really. I mean, even last episode,
the phrase,
I don't remember, that was fantastic.
Are you telling me in 1968 there's an international oceanic limbo where murder is smiled upon? It's Pete, self-righteous Pete is hilarious Pete.
Just the language he uses, smiled upon.
Oh, yeah.
It's hilarious.
Well, it's just like his shameful day routine. I really appreciated what he said it, but he said it in a very funny, over-the-top way.
Yeah, and now looking back on the scene with him and Harry, where he calls out Harry about bona fide racist.
Right.
That's over-the-top. That's obviously supposed to be comedy as well.
He's got this trumped-up foghorn leghorn way of saying things that's hilarious.
Definitely.
And if he doesn't know that it's funny, he's an idiot. And I don't think Vincent Kartheiser is an idiot.
Okay, good enough. Ted tells Peggy that he's going to California without her. It's the next scene. Crushes Peggy in this scene. And I wish Peggy had reacted a little bit more. Yes, she got in a good line.
This was a huge reaction for Peggy.
For Peggy, but I wish she had let loose a little bit more rather than just cross her arms and take it.
I
feel like something should have come off her desk, you know?
Yeah, I mean, like lots of shades of Lady Edith from Downton Abbey here. Like the fact that this person has no choices that they're allowed to make themselves.
Yeah, well, aren't you lucky to have decisions?
Did you notice, many people did, the fact that the outfit she was wearing was literally identical to the outfit that she was wearing for her interview with Ted From last season?
No, I didn't.
It's identical. The only thing different was the scarf she's wearing around her neck. So it's all right, like
that makes sense.
We talked about the, you know, the Don Draper bookends we're going to kickstart last episode. Can we kickstart a Peggy bookend of her wearing that dress
with two different color scarves?
No, you just have the same scarf. It's bronze, man. I'm not going to paint them. That'd ruin the effect. It'd ruin the classiness of it.
All right. Sure, I don't give a shit what you want to kickstart. Do it.
I know we're running behind, but I thought Molly from Grantland had. Actually, I was very disappointed in most people's reviews this week. I thought Tom and Lorenzo were a little off. I thought Steppenwall's a little off, but I thought she was right on. She said Ted led her on all season with promises of future happiness, and then couldn't help but sample the merchandise before deciding to put it back on a shelf.
Yep,
he had plenty of chances to pull back and do the right thing, and he squandered them on flirtatious glances and movie dates. His condescending tone alerting Peggy that she'd thank him later for not ruining her life was just as bad as any of Don's rants at her. Agree?
Yeah, I have written here in my notes, I love you so much, I never want to see you again. Bullshit, Ted.
Yeah.
Bullshit.
I mean, that's just such a self-serving...
Oh, yeah.
Pontius Pilate type hand-washing, it's total bullshit.
Of the highest order.
She also observed that Peggy keeps finding herself attracted to men who won't go to bat for her, who make her their second choice, while assuring her that she deserves to be someone's first, who break down her defenses and then beg her to put them back up.
Telling you, man, she should have hooked up with Stan.
Yes.
Stan's A, going places, and probably got the good hookup on the weed.
Not anymore.
No, not anymore.
I feel like I took the Don and Peggy ship, the SS Don Peggy, Don Deggy, took a fatal torpedoing this episode. Like I'm kind of feeling like I would be disappointed if they got together at this point.
Yeah. I don't see that happening.
Whereas before I thought it'd be absurd, but I would actually be secretly delighted. Now I'd be like, no, Peggy needs to find a good man.
Yeah.
Not a project, not a fixer-upper.
In the next year is going to turn into a good man. He's got far...
Well, he's got a lot
far longer of a journey.
He needs to fucking fix his daughters and and sons before he worries about the next piece of ass, honestly.
Yeah. Somehow I don't see that happening, but...
No. Not before the series is over, I don't think.
Yep. Anyways, Don breaks the news about California to Megan, and she takes it pretty hard and leaves. She's out the door.
Fuck the agency. Not another stealth. We got another neutron F-bomb.
Yeah, it was bleeped. Lame. Or not bleeped, but just silenced.
Mm-hmm.
You think season finale, they'd let one drop, right?
I don't think they're allowed any. They're allowed
zero?
A certain number of ones bleeped, but I don't think they're allowed to say the F-bomb ever.
Wow. That's so lame. So lame. Anyway, yeah, I mean, Don is still just making decisions for himself here. Yes, it was noble of him to let Ted go to California, but it was also a pretty shitty thing to do to Megan.
I don't know. I feel like Don could have gave the same speech that Ted gave to Peggy, but he's classier about not doing it. This could be the best thing that ever happened to Megan, honestly.
Just getting her out of there?
Well, letting her letting her go and pursue her dreams.
Yeah. So he suggested that they be bi-coastal.
And honestly,
she goes to California and he stays there.
It would not shock me if that's where we find out, like, you know, because we saw their marriage at the breaking point last season. They came back. Everything was fine.
Yep.
I could entirely buy the fact that they're going to try to bi-coastal thing because Wiener didn't slam any doors shut this episode, except on poor Dorothy. you know, Don's kind of fired, but the door's cracked open. Megan's left, but not definitively.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a lot of wiggle room to play around with here, which is encouraging and frightening at the same time.
And he also opens up the door of Don losing his job at the end, essentially.
That's what I said, yeah. I mean, he's fired, but not all the way. Not completely, totally...
Yeah, well, I'm talking about as far as where that leaves Megan and Don.
I gotcha.
He could potentially go with her for the next few months to California and set everything up and be happy out there for a little while and maybe patch things up.
Yep. Which is also, there's a storm cloud in that rapid fire sequence of things you just talked about, which we'll get to here in a minute.
Okay. So Pete's staying at Trudy's house temporarily. He goes over there before he leaves for Los Angeles. She's going to her parents and taking the kid, and he's saying goodbye to his daughter for the holidays. Some pretty poignant stuff coming from Trudy in this scene about Pete having thrown it all away, and Pete saying that's not how he wanted it, but now he knows.
Which, that is a slight opening for them to get back together, maybe?
It is, and the scene when he's in the bedroom talking to his daughter, or not talking to her, but rubbing her hair or whatever. Mm-hmm. She comes up behind him, and she's looking at him, and she seems pleased by that scene.
Also, that's the exact same framing as the end of the pilot episode of Mad Men, Smoke in Your Eyes, where Don goes in to check on his kids, Betty's watching him kind of lovingly.
Doesn't bode well for Pete.
Well, short term it does. If he's a faster learner than Don. Also, speaking of framing, I forgot to bring it total circle when Don is in the conference room with the Hershey's exec. The framing of the shot was exactly opposite. When he was going to L.A., we shot from behind. When he's staying in New York, we're seeing him head on. Also, I hope I don't forget to remember to talk about this next week. Is a very interesting callback to the artwork that we saw preseason of the two Dons.
Oh, yeah, the tentacle
passing
porn.
Each other.
Yeah, yeah.
No.
Gotcha.
No, the two Dons passing each other.
Yes, definitely. Should we move on to the next scene?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you want to talk a little bit about Pete?
Okay. Nope.
GLP is done for the season. No more Pete. The partners tell Don that he's taking a leave of absence for a few months. As Don is leaving, he sees his replacement. I thought this is a scene that I was talking about that was lit phenomenally, or it felt underlit. I know it was supposed to be very early in the morning, like 9 o'clock or so.
On a holiday, no less.
Yes,
so most people
holiday,
aren't even there.
Which lighting totally different on holidays. Sun doesn't come up till like 11.
Not only that, but the lights in the office were not on.
Yeah, gotcha. And I thought that added a lot of, what's the word I'm looking for? Not drama.
Ambiance?
No.
Foreboding?
Yes, it was very foreboding lighting in that room. A lot of atmosphere to that scene. Having it was low contrast, too. It didn't feel like there were any colors in that room. It felt like all of it had been just sucked out of the room.
I gotta say, Bert Cooper's been impressive the last two seasons. He went from basically kind of being this doddering old fuck that had checked out.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one that smoked out Lane. He's the one that put the hammer down on Don this episode. Like Don was starting to bluster and bullshit, and he's basically like, you know what, you're not on trial, and the verdict's already been reached.
Yeah, sit down.
Boom, chong chong.
yeah. Bert Cooper. Was he wearing socks in this scene?
And I don't know. Not a tentacle to be seen. He's in professional mode.
So. I was especially struck by Don's descent from the top of SC&P to the very bottom of this building.
Yeah.
His walk down the stairs, his seeing Duck with whoever this guy is.
Lou Avery,
I forget his name, who we've seen plenty before.
Yeah, he's one of the assholes that Roger was taunting in the airport going out to the Chevy meeting.
Yeah, from one of the other agencies.
Mm-hmm.
So he's potentially... being brought in to replace Don.
Now, what would be interesting about what I think is interesting when I talk about the storm cloud is the whole Ted feels he can oversee Peggy from LA.
Mm-hmm.
Oh boy. Do you think that this is ultimately going to mean a meaningless sacrifice because Ted will have to be for several months involved day to day with Peggy after he's just basically blown up their relationship? Either they're going to, how the hell do you manage someone like that?
I don't know. I feel like if anything
happens. And then left. Like yesterday's laundry, garbage, whatever.
I don't know. I've never been in that situation. But I feel like if anybody's going, Peggy is going. Because Ted is a partner. And
well, not only that, but Peggy, like, she started on this arc trying to get the hell away from this. And she got sucked back in against her will.
Yeah.
So,
and then it contaminated everything around her, and she ended up paying the price.
I could totally get behind her and Stan forming an agency. Because
Stan wants to build something.
Peggy's qualified. They could do it.
Oh, yeah. Peggy is qualified.
And Harry.
Peggy's the new creative director.
Stan, right? Harry, and Peggy going out to L.A. and start a new television advertising empire.
And Harry. Fuck Harry. He's going to start a White Castle in the middle of Ohio. Ugh. And he's going to make no money because he eats all the burgers. Yeah, so I don't know. Great scene again. Roger goes over to Joan's house for Thanksgiving. And lo and behold, who's there? Bob Benson.
Carving the turkey in a frilled apron.
Carving the Thanksgiving turkey.
Making sure that Roger knew that Gail got her hair done for you.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Yeah, anyone... Yeah, Bob's gay as the day is long.
Gay as the wind.
Yep.
For sure. I'm going to make that a thing. Gay as the wind.
Gay as the wind.
I don't know why, because the wind isn't particularly gay, but...
I don't know.
Whatever. Yeah, so... Do you think that Joan knows that?
Oh, hell yeah. Like, I'm very convinced that...
Yeah? Okay.
Oh, I mean, the whole line of... Joan and Bob's kind of... I mean, that's classic. You know, the whole, like, oh, I've gained so much weight. Oh, but you can't tell. I mean, like, Tom and Lorenzo said that Peggy is the classic... I forget what they called.
Joan is the beard. Yeah, the beard. Yeah,
no, but they had another word for it. It wasn't... Oh, shit, I can't think of it.
Hmm.
But basically, a woman who enjoys the company of gay men, and
they kind of
look up to her like a big sister, and she kind of dotes over them, and it's very kind of a sweet type of relationship. Don't have any experience with this. I'm just going on with what Tolo is saying.
Yeah.
But I totally buy that. That seems entirely innocent, and Roger's an idiot that he can't see it.
Okay, and so Joan telling Roger that I'm inviting you into your kid's life, not into my life.
Is a shutting the door on him, not opening to Bob.
What?
Yeah, Joan's basically saying...
It's her not wanting to give Roger any clue as to Bob's sexual orientation, considering that is a big deal at the time.
Well, I also think that she wants Bob and him or Roger to know that I don't want to start this tryst up again that we've had for a decade.
It's definitely that.
That's over. You don't get a say of what I do with my life. It's basically her claiming her relational space, which I thought was awesome.
Yeah. So my question in this scene would be, I know that Roger's secretary made a good case to Joan about Roger not being happy, but do you think Bob had a hand, any kind of hand, in getting Roger back into his kid's life? Do you think he was intimidated and he needed to do a good deed for Roger?
No, that would weaken Peggy or Joan, and I can't abide that.
Okay, fair enough.
I think Peggy Joan did this of her own volition, for her own reasons, and for what she thought is the greater good of Kevin.
Yeah.
And on her own terms. So if it blows up that she's basically given Roger enough rope to hang himself if he wants it.
Yep. Peggy's working in Don's old office as Stan leaves, and she is enjoying it. She likes that corner office.
Another Peggy from the back shot. We saw another one of those earlier in the season. It's Peggy taking on the mantle of Don.
Yep. Literally, I mean, she's taking his office.
But there's another bittersweet storm cloud, because she thinks that she's going to be the creative director when obviously Sterling Koo and P is hedging their bets with Lou Avery.
Sterling Koo and P. That's the official name.
Sterkoopy.
I'm sorry, I was thrown off by that. What did you say?
They're already hedging. Like, she thinks she's going to be the creative director.
Ah, yes, but they're bringing in other people.
They're hedging their bets, at least.
Yes, for sure.
So she's not going to get. I mean, nobody gets exactly what they want in this episode.
Fair enough. And in what I think is probably the second best scene in the episode, Don shows his kids where he grew up. I like this particularly because this felt to me like Don's way of. So earlier in the episode, I said that he had recognized what he had been doing to his family. I mean, certainly that conversation with Betty clued him into it, and all the things that have happened with him and Sally. And I think that this is his way of not allowing himself to hide this anymore. Like, I'm going to show my kids where I grew up. It's going to be a topic of conversation, and I can't go back from this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, once I show them, that's it. This is out there. And it was the same with the Hershey's. Like, I'm putting this out on the table because this is the only way I'm going to even begin to heal all the damage that I've done. And it's particularly poignant, the look that Sally gives him at the end of this episode.
And there was... I listened to Bill Simmons, who had both Alan Sepinwall and Andy Greenberg from... or Greenwald, I think, from Grantland on his podcast to discuss in an hour and a half episode Game of Thrones and Mad Men's finales. Mm-hmm. And they all seem to think that Kirina Shipka is a bad actress.
What?
I think that she did a hell of a job in another wordless performance of conveying five or six different emotions.
Yes.
Like, this isn't over between us, old man. I'm starting to see where it's you're all about.
Yeah, she is certainly
I'm shocked. I appreciate the vulnerability. It's not, you know, it's like, again, a lot of emotions.
Yeah, there was compassion. There was understanding. There was still a little bit of animosity and anger. I mean, this was not all a good look.
Yeah, if anything, I think she's weakest when she has to work with other shitty actresses, like the different... child actors that she's had to deal with this year, and Glenn, Matthew Weiner's son, who can still to this day, like, I'm warming up to him, and I think he's kind of cool in this weird square type of way, but the man can't act.
No. I actually thought all of the child actors in the last episode were pretty horrible, including Sally. I thought she performed pretty badly at points.
But I'm saying when she's got John Hamm,
yes,
or Slattery, or the other, or even January Jones, ones that she's been comfortable with and has basically grown up with. Uh-huh. I mean, think about, like, she's literally grown up with these characters. She is capable of putting in an A-plus performance.
I think she's really good at playing that kind of broken little girl, and I think when you put her in kind of normal situations... it doesn't work out as well.
Well, I mean, she's not like a Dakota Fanning. She's not like a Natalie Portman type that can just completely own it all by herself. But to say that she's terrible or she wasn't effective in this scene is a gross injustice.
Completely. Completely agree. Do you have anything to say about this episode in closing?
Because
that is the last scene.
Yeah, the end song was really poignant too. The both from both sides, I believe, is what it's called. You know, listen to it. It's a heartbreaker. It's too bad AMC steps over that.
I know. I wish just on the season finale they would let that play out.
At least the season finale.
Next week on The Killing.
Yeah, like I don't give a shit. Number one about The Killing. Yeah. Or really Breaking Bad or anything after I'm absorbing this. But just let Matt Weiner have his way as far as setting the final tone. I mean, this is...
yeah, the story is not over when the first credit rolls.
Yes, it's real. I mean, AMC, at least for the finale, for Christ's sake.
Yes, yeah. At first, I thought they were going to. They let it go, I think, maybe like 15 seconds or
so. Yeah, yeah. We got the first stanza, and then, you know... there's a lot of really cool imagery about, you know, this woman who's looking at clouds and they're these fantastic images, but then she sees the other side where they bring rain and snow and they, you know, get you can obscure your vision. And then she later on compares that to the love that, you know, love has two sides to it too, a wonderful side and a terrible side. And in fact, at the very end of the song, she kind of realizes that's life as well. And
yeah,
you know, that is something that's, you know, so who's there's standing there at the end? Is that Don Draper? Is that Dick Whitman?
Oh, I think it's still very much Don Draper.
You don't think
I think he wants to become Dick Whitman. I think okay, this is not completely my opinion. I mean, inside Mad Men, again, I'll go back to that. Call Weiner the liar that you want to, but he very much says that Don has not changed. He may be taking a step toward changing. Don't think that this is a completely new leaf for Don and that he is going to be happy-go-lucky next season.
All right.
He is beginning on a journey that may lead to change if he's willing to follow it there. So, no, do not think this is Dick Whitman standing there.
This finale, and we'll talk about this next week, ended way more hopeful and optimistic. And there's nothing saying the Weiner has to go that way, but I wouldn't even thought it possible to have this up of an ending
yeah.
for this season.
Yeah, with right up to the end, right up to where he's fired.
Yeah.
This has been a very down season.
And you know, the other thing I want to stake out here before like people analyze it to death, I want to get my claim on it, is I've been saying for a couple weeks, and well, from the beginning, you know, 3 or 4 episodes in, that, you know, that's Don Draper's descent through hell, and he's going to have various Beatrices lead him out of it. Uh-huh. And I feel like that, you know, it started with Sylvia. Peggy continued to doing it. Betty continued to work, but it's ultimately Sally who is the one that kind of leads him out of this hell into this kind of salvation. We got a wonderful listener feedback speaking to this later on. In fact, are we ready? I mean, do we have anything else to say that we can't wait till next week?
Well, I want to go.
My voice is starting to give out, and I still have at least a half hour of feedback to read.
Okay, well, I want to go back to the idea that Dick Whitman and Don Draper are two different people. I don't think they are. I mean, certainly Don Draper is an alter ego, but we have seen that Dick Whitman as a person was broken long before he became Don Draper.
Yeah.
I think that is what this season has shown us, right?
Mm-hmm.
Through these flashbacks, we finally get an idea of why Don is who Don is, and that happened in his childhood.
Mm.
Before he had any thought about running away and becoming Don Draper.
All right. Right on.
So, anyway, yeah, that's all I have to say about this.
All right.
Let's get us feedback. I'll save it for next week. Save it for next week.
Okay.
Save it for the podcast.
A little bit of promo. Please check out our Kickstarter. This is second to last opportunity. We'll have to pitch it to you. But we're over halfway through our campaign. We've hit a lot of our stretch goals to improve our coverage of Breaking Good or Breaking Bad on our Breaking Good podcast next year. If you haven't checked it already, please go to kickstarter.baldmove.com. Check out our rewards. Check out the goals. The two major ones we've got left to go are
nude photos. No, that's my other Kickstarter. Sorry.
Daily news updates, which I in the update post, I gave examples of what those looked like for season 4. And the ultimate prize, if we achieve the top goal, is we release the podcast on Monday, not Tuesday. So we still have those to unlock. Thanks to everyone that supported us so far. Moving off the special stuff to the more mundane stuff, we're, of course, part of the Bald Move Network. We cover The Walking Dead, Game of Thrones, Mad Men, Justified, Breaking Bad, Downton Abbey with Tom and Kelly. They just wrapped up their coverage of Mr. Selfridge. It'll be interesting to see what they do next in their off season. We also got the boys, the Personal Arrogance crew, Eric and Jesse out of Seattle. Congratulations to Eric.
Yeah.
His t-shirt design for Game of Thrones is Seattle Mariners t-shirt concept won a contest, and they'll be giving away t-shirts with his design on it to the first 5,000 fans to go to the next Mariners ball game. So congratulations. Also, Eric is working on our Kickstarter t-shirt design too. So you've got a semi-professional designer.
Oh, that's news to me even.
Yeah. Breaking news, working on that. They talk about this. I know it's Superman cause I got my dander up. Apparently Eric likes it. I think it's a piece of shit. I hope he reads my feedback on it. Don't forget about the Picasso show, the three fantastic gals from LA holding things down, all things women. They just had an awesome listener meetup that was pretty successful out there.
Yep.
It's cool if anyone got to attend. And we always appreciate ratings and reviews on iTunes. It's what makes our show get bigger. It's some sick percentage of our new listeners come from iTunes. And the way they find us is that we rise to the top of the rankings based on your recent reviews. So everyone that's done that this year, thank you so much. Again, if you've enjoyed our coverage, you don't have the money to give to our Kickstarter, you don't use Amazon, the one thing you can always do to support us is throw us a little love on the iTunes reviews way. So we appreciate that. You can use your Amazon affiliate link at amazon.baldmove.com. I'm not going to explain how that works because everybody knows by now. Or tell a friend, get them on the Bald Move, enroll them into the Bald Move Army, the Bald Move Empire. I'm ready to read. I'm not ready to read. My throat's dying at this point. I'm
going to
read some feedback. Craig P. says, guys, don't want to embarrass you, but Chris Sarandon and not Harry Hamlin played Prince Humperdinck in The Princess Bride. Harry Hamlin is best known for L.A. Law and also for playing Perseus in original Clash of the Titans. Keep up the good work, guys. I can't believe I got that wrong.
And I can't believe the torrent of feedback
Oh my God, we got so many people correcting me for such an obvious mistake. I will maintain the dudes have a striking similarity.
They do. It's the jawline, I think.
Now that they're older, Harry Hamlin still looks like Harry Hamlin. Mm-hmm. Chris Sarandon is morphed into like Christopher Plummer. Like he's gone like a slightly younger Hammer Horror Days Christopher Plummer, but they don't look anything alike.
People are screaming at their mics or at their earbuds again because it's Sarandon, not Sarandon.
Chris Saranwrap. moving on, Mike C. I'm a 41-year-old, well-educated professional male who's a TV and movie addict, and I've never seen A Princess Bride. And I never fucking will. I think A-Ron said it best when he called it a point of pride. Oh, Jesus. This is red meat for you,
fucker. Yeah.
At least once or twice a year this happens. It comes up in conversations. I have not seen it. People have a reaction like they just learned that 9/11 happened. Then they say, you have to see it. And 15 minutes later, after they just regurgitated all the funny lines and scenes, I respond with, well, no point in seeing it now that you've recreated an entire fucking movie for me. If I hear my name is blah, 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 you killed my father, prepare to die one more time when Homeland is mentioned, I may contact Abu Nazir and ask for my own vest. It's become a defining characteristic of my life that I've not seen this movie. This dude is me, man.
To the T. And he has a massively good point here. Because I have seen, through my friends, that entire movie many, many times. Yeah. I've seen it acted out in front of me. I have no desire to see it anymore because I know all the funny stuff that happens.
Well, Mike C. has got your back, Jim. I don't think you needed it. Stubborn pride that you have. Andrew says, Peggy has a history of shady activity in movie theaters. I think it's safe to assume that she gave Ted a hand jibber. Also, do you think the date that Peggy had to run through is in the next theater over?
Wow.
I want to defend Peggy, but that's pretty funny. Can't.
Yeah.
Cynthia says, I've been saying ever since the Zooby Zooby Zoo episode that that Megan and Don wouldn't last long. Then after the Hojo episodes, I'm sure their marriage was headed for the toilet, but they're still married. I should say that these are all previous podcast emails that didn't make the deadline. But Don is still the same emotionally abusive man he's been all along. These two need to split. Megan's too young and too soft-hearted for Don, and he is too selfish and sensitive to her. So my prediction is that there has to be an event that finally opens Megan's eyes and she makes Don move out. I hope it's this Sunday.
Good Cynthia? Prediction.
It's kind of Schrodinger's divorce because we won't know for sure for another 10 months. But I would say you have a very strong claim on being right on that one.
Definitely.
Elise K. says, where does Jim get his information? Miss Porter's school is located in Farmington, Connecticut. It's a town, not a slang term. You fucking idiot. I threw that in myself.
Yeah, I saw that.
You could use it every once in a while, honestly.
I don't know where I got that. I was reading an article and I misread.
I grew up calling it Sarah Porter's, a whole other social group residing side by side to my immigrant mother and her family. She grew up right near the campus. My grandfather was the groundskeeper for the school, and the house my mom grew up in is now faculty housing. Lo, how many alcoholics must stay there? Booze hounds. The scenes of Sally meeting with the headmistress or admissions lady looks a lot like the school does today. Although CT is the third smallest state in the country, it's got the most private boarding schools of any state. Glenn attends Hotchkiss, which is in Lakeville, Connecticut, just an hour from Farmington. You asked about what the characters were watching in the previous episode. I noticed they were watching Hawaii 5-0. I surprised because I remember watching as a kid around 72, but it did premiere in the fall of 1968.
Wow.
A very nice reference to the premiere episode, which took place in Hawaii. Waiting with bated breath for Breaking Bad's August 11th return. Us two. Yep. We're so super pumped.
Just had a big-ass discussion about it tonight.
Yeah, we did over dinner. And that, you know, well, like I said, we're always excited. Hell, now we're getting paid to do it. So, like, our raging Breaking Bad boners are raging. Edwin C. says, so it looks like all the pieces are in place with this Sharon Tate connection to Megan with her going to California. But that wasn't the only foreshadowing of death. So he's not giving up that theory. Now that she's going to L.A., it's even stronger. That wasn't the only foreshadowing of death in this episode. Early in the episode, Roger tells Bob Benson that it's all fun and games until someone shoots you in the face. Could this be foreshadowing that Bob will be shot? We did see Pete polishing that gun last episode, and Bob is fucking with Pete to the point where I wouldn't be surprised if he does decide to cap that son of a bitch.
Oh, man. We come back and Pete's in prison for shooting Bob.
The Pete Pit Part 2.
Ugh.
Pete Pit Harder.
The Pete Penitentiary.
The Pete, the Pete Pin. It's a Pete Pin.
Pete Pin.
That gun's got to do something, right?
Yes, it has to.
His secretary just lampshaded. You can't kill anything with that gun.
Yep.
I mean, that's waving red. That's waving a red flag in front of a bull. As an aside, he says, also, please bring back the Justified podcast. I don't know if you watched last season, but damn, that was some good storytelling.
Oh.
Point of fact, we actually covered the entire season as part of our Bald Move TV podcast. We tried a thing where we did multiple shows in a single hour, an hour and a half episode. So we actually did the whole season 4. You might want to check it out there, Edwin. You can find it from any of our other shows' links on iTunes. It's one of the related casts. Or on baldmove.com. Corey L. says, I feel bad for people who claim season 6 started out slow and stopped watching. I pity the poor fuckers, too. This season kicked ass. Any Mad Men fan should trust the wiener enough to know that his relationships and conflicts set up in the beginning pay off beyond satisfaction.
Oh. Oh, you guilty bastard.
What?
Yeah, you. You. Well, okay. So I don't know if you did this, but we were talking just before the podcast about shows that have earned the reputation to give them the benefit of the doubt when they start off slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And that something will pay off.
Mm-hmm.
And Mad Men is certainly one of those shows for me.
Yeah.
What shows were you saying you didn't think that of?
Walking Dead.
Well, yeah.
I think
that has never paid off.
I don't know, because I was just saying that I learned my lesson that year with, like, Breaking Bad, because the first, you know, season finale of, or season premiere of season 5, you know, I was comparing it to Box Cutter. And it's like, oh, it's got this weird flash forward and what the fuck. But by the end of the season, yeah, it totally made sense. And I'm like, you know what? The Villigan's got some slack. He's going to have to deliver a bunch of mediocre episodes or some shitty ones before I dare question him again.
Yeah.
And I think the Wiener's at that level.
Certainly.
You know, the double D's over at Game of Thrones are at that level.
Mm-hmm.
I have complete faith, and I'm not going to worry about whether they're going to deliver on the promise of their material until they prove they'd have to, they're going to have to go the other way and prove otherwise. Anyway, it goes, the only complaint is that Don's storyline wasn't addressed anytime after an MLK assassination. It seems like a bit of a missed opportunity to explore new topics in the show. Do you agree?
Totally.
Totally, Corey. We are very puzzled about what the hell happened with Don. I mean, they gave her some spotlight moments in the mid-season, and then they just didn't pay off.
Yeah, like, absolutely nothing. I mean, why even concern yourself with her relationship status if you're not going to do anything with it?
So I heard a rumor, and I think this was from Andy Greenwald, that Matt Weiner spent so much time doing the two-hour finale with on-shoot, because they film everything in Hollywood, believe it or not.
Okay.
With on-scene location filming and getting the tone just right and spending so much on post-production that the next 3 to 4 episodes, you know, a lot of people were not a fan of, and it's kind of samey and it felt rushed and kind of pointless, that he basically robbed from Peter to pay Paul there. Don might be a casualty of that, because that is not the kind of careful plotting that we've seen from Matthew Weiner. That setup, there was setup, bump set, no spike.
Yeah.
So I wonder if the spike is saved for next year.
Or if the spike just doesn't happen.
Could be.
Yeah.
It might be like Pete's 22. Anyway, thanks for the recaps. We'll be tuning in for the new and improved Breaking Good in August. Thanks, Corey. We'll see you there. Mike G says, wow, what a season. This may have been my favorite season of Mad Men. I agree, honestly. I do think it's after this last finale, it goes over season 3, which is my previous reigning champ. What about you, Jim? Or save it for next cast.
Let's save it.
Just want to write in some feedback regarding the spiritual religious arc Don traveled on this season. This is great. It's long. My voice is going to hate me for it, but I got to read it. This season, of course, began with Don reading Dante's Inferno. Thematically, this set the stage for Don's character arc for the season. Throughout the season, Don went through his own personal version of hell. This is especially clear in the final episodes of the season. Last week was when it got really dark for Don. His drinking was as bad as it ever was. His relationship with Megan was on life support. And his relationship with Sally was in shambles. We also had Rosemary's Baby as Wiener's literary device. Don in the fetal position. Don acting out the whine of a baby. Don was deep into his hell. In terms of Don's character status, this week's finale picks up with last week left off. Don's drinking is severe. When Don is at the bar drinking himself into submission, he provokes the minister's attention. Don says, "I didn't mean to engage you." However, the minister points out the truth, but you did. Don subconsciously incites the minister to throw him a life raft. This scene marks the beginning of a transition for Don. The minister stimulates a flashback for Don. He's back to his childhood's whorehouse. The man of God says, "Repentance is your only salvation." Then he specifically tells the young Dick, "The only unpardonable sin is to believe God cannot forgive you." The transition between the dark and the dawn overlaps, of course, because Don punches the minister in the face. After Don gets out of the drunk tank, we see him pouring the liquor down the drain. At the Hershey's meeting, he tells the Hershey's execs his true child experience with Hershey's Bar. In Don's world, this is akin to a religious confession. Who would Don most likely withhold his true story from? I'd say potential clients and his peers, i.e. fellow partners, are at the top of the list. Obviously, this was bad for business and got Don into trouble, but for Don, this was a significant spiritual step out of hell and towards redemption. He thought about Ted wanting to save his family. Ted didn't want his children to grow up in a broken home. Betty tells Don earlier that Sally's problems are because she's from a broken home. Don tells Ted he wants him to go to California. Don's shaky hands triggered him to do things differently because the way he was doing things did not work. In the final scene, Don shows his children the house he grew up with, the whorehouse from the flashback. Sally gives her father a look that's difficult to describe. She herself knows that this is something significant for her father to do. She knew about pieces of her father's past, but it came from her mother playing mind games with her father. Sally knows her father is opening up about his past of his own free will. I'm not sure if too many people noticed, but the shot of the house, there's a little black boy eating a popsicle in the porch. If you remember back to the popsicle campaign from season 2, Peggy came up with the idea of the popsicle being symbolic of Holy Communion. I think that's why Wiener had the boy eating the popsicle. Remember, it's Thanksgiving, not exactly a time of year affiliated with frozen treats. This scene is symbolically a communion for Don, that is, another spiritual step out of hell and back to earth. In Catholicism, you cannot receive communion unless you have recently been to confession. Don's confession was during the Hershey meeting. His communion was his childhood home with his children. He goes on to say, I don't mean to imply that Don has redeemed himself. However, all signs point to the beginning of Don's redemption. His marriage is on the brink of destruction. He's essentially lost his job, the job that's so conjoined with his Don Draper identity. The normal Don we know would have lost his shit. He would have responded to these events with alcohol, sex, and misery. Yet now he's doing things differently. His response was to take another spiritual step in his journey by taking himself and his children to the place he once repressed. It seems to me that Don is on the path of redemption. What do you think?
Yeah, I think I very much agree with his conclusion there.
Yeah, very strong analysis. Thank you. Moving on, to keep the pace going, Duncan C. says, "I want you to imagine an orphan in a whorehouse and on his face a single tear, and in that tear are all the tears, all the orphans crying."
Okay.
That's obviously a reference to Roger's weirdo LSD buddy.
The guy, Ethan from Lost,
yeah,
who pitches
the MLK came and said that,
yeah.
Into a dream that he wanted him to do a racial riot ad campaign.
Uh-huh.
He continues, "Dick Whitman only gets angry when a preacher tells him that none of the Kennedys, MLKs, or the Vietnam people are true Christians. I'd like to think that Dick is unusually sensitive to slights against MLK, but I suspect, bookending the season, this is to do with his identification with the soldiers in Vietnam, like the kid he met in the season premiere. Foreshadowing, Bob Benson will marry Joan and throw her off the side of a ship."
Yep.
After he sabotages Pete, "All I got from driver's ed was blue balls. Campbell with Chevy, I'm wondering if he has... he is the one who shot Ken from behind the grassy knoll." Wow. Nicely awesome. Done, Duncan. Ellen, I thought as uncomfortable as Don's Hershey speech was, it was probably the most connected I've felt to his character in the show's 6 seasons. I think it's because even though we've known him for a long time, that Don's childhood was far from his dad ruffling his hair in a drugstore. It's always been side knowledge. Don's childhood has always been told to us through flashbacks and dreams. So much like Don's kids, we don't really know anything about him from his perspective. It's one of the only times we've ever heard him be candid and frank and it's certainly the most honest we've ever seen. So, really good points there, Ellen. I'm going to take a drink to try to try to rally here.
I'm going to entertain while you do that. And it's done.
What?
You're back. You drank.
Okay. Kirk says, when Betty was talking with Don on the phone about Sally's trouble with alcohol, she said, the one thing that really stuck with me, the good is not beating the bad. I thought that was a particularly timely thing to say in 1968, as it could probably sum up the entire year's major events. Hmm. Can you read the next two for me?
Sure.
Thank you.
Ben says, should there even be a seventh season? At the end of this season, Don has entered his third life. He was Dick Whitman, then he became Don Draper. Now he becomes a reborn Dick Whitman again. Presumably, the seventh season will feature a Don that can now connect and love his family. Certainly, the Wiener will not pull the same gambit again with Don backsliding. It would certainly be fun, especially to me since I'm a Don apologist, to see SCP implode without Don there, with Ted away, and presumably a self-destructive Peggy now in charge of pitches. But does the seventh season just answer questions that are better left hopeful/ominous?
I say we table that for next week.
Definitely. We will discuss that probably in depth. Jamie says, I'll start by saying that I have a hard time enjoying a TV show or film if I don't like the characters. For example, even though Glengarry Glen Ross, yeah, love that movie, had a brilliant screenplay and fantastic performances, I didn't like the movie because all of the characters were so grotesque and irredeemable. And I stopped watching Walking Dead a few seasons ago because so many of the characters were stupid and obnoxious.
Can't take issue with that.
But it's never been like that with Mad Men. Wiener and company do such an amazing job of making even their most unlikable characters fascinating. Pete Campbell is a rapey, sour, grimy little pimp, but I'm enraptured by his scenes. Much of that is due to Vincent Kartheiser's performance, but it also is due to the fact that the writers created a multi-layered character with strengths and weaknesses. It's more than a love-to-hate situation, although I do enjoy hating him. He's just an interesting character to watch.
Yeah, man.
I completely agree. She goes on, they do the same with the likable characters, too. For example, Peggy is probably one of the most sympathetic characters on the show, but she is far from perfect. She slept with two married men. She flaunted her sexuality at the office to get back at Ted. She gave some dude a handy at the movie theater while involved with Abe. She's no saint, which makes her all the more reliable, or all the more relatable.
She also stabbed Abe in the gut with a homemade spear. That's a small flaw.
And she finishes up, the Wiener can create multifaceted characters like no other, and that's the reason why I think Mad Men is one of the greatest shows of all time.
Yeah, man, you compare Pete to, like, Andrea.
Oh.
And you just kind of weep for the missed opportunities.
To be fair, I mean, we are talking about the absolute height of television, right?
Well,
I mean, you and I agree, and we haven't seen every series under the sun, certainly, but this is probably, I would say, maybe the best show ever made. You would say certainly the second best.
It could threaten the
depending on this last season.
The Wire's vulnerability is season 5.
Yeah.
And if Mad Men closes perfectly, I don't think it can surpass The Wire. It's not as important, but it certainly could pull even. I mean, the fact that's on the table for me is amazing.
Yeah, definitely. You have been staunch about your love for The Wire for a long time. But I'm just saying, comparing other shows to this show may not be the most fair thing in the world, right?
Well,
we may, in fact, have some television geniuses working on this show.
That's true. That's true. And they're actually not just geniuses. They were the progeny of geniuses themselves. I mean, Wiener famously cut his teeth on The Sopranos, and Gilligan famously cut his teeth on The X-Files. So they stood on the shoulders of giants. But that said, they were aiming for that with The Walking Dead.
Yeah, they missed
the
mark.
They've decided for whatever reason it doesn't need to be as good of a show as it could be. And that pisses me off as a fan of television.
Yeah, I'm with you. Maybe next season they'll bring in Matt Weiner to spruce up Walking Dead.
Nobody watching Mad Men but us cares about The Walking Dead. So.
Fair enough. Anyway, Nina writes in. She says, I also felt sympathy for Betty in this episode. As a mother to a 14-year-old girl who hasn't given me a day of trouble, knock on wood, I know how terrifying parenthood is when things are going well. To feel like your child requires more than you know how to give, whether or not Betty can ever learn To be a better mother is another conversation, is scary. Sure, Betty sucks, but I felt like her anguish when she was speaking to Don was more about what the hell they're going to do to get their child on the right path and less about pointing the finger, as she usually does. Totally agree with that. Pete is an asshole, but damn if I didn't laugh out loud during almost every scene he was in. And fuck Ted. I know everyone lauded him all season as being a good guy, but I knew this was leading to nothing but heartache for Peggy. When she gave it up in her apartment, I actually yelled at the TV, "Well, there goes that."
Did you see on Reddit someone did one of the publicity stills of Peggy, and they put IFT?
Yeah, that's awesome.
Breaking Bad friends.
Telling you, man, those oranges are not a good sign.
I know. Fucking juggling those oranges is going to get you killed, Ted.
Do you think Manolo killed Pete's mama?
And now he's going out for the sun-kissed account?
Oh, no.
Oh, he's a dead man.
Dead man.
Dead man.
We'll move on to Bill. He says, Don is a Monsanto tomato. The skin looks great, but the inside is a chemical-riddled mess. And his 50s ideal life slowly fell apart. His advertising prowess dropped with it. Don's ad game and life have been sliding downhill since the show's beginning. His desperate grabs at normalcy, committing to Betty, marrying Megan, etc., have all fallen flat. And the perfect 50s ideal man is revealed to be more and more flawed and conflicted man of his time. Can I quickly take issue with something?
Sure.
I don't think that Don's ad game has slipped.
Yes. No, I don't.
I think his judgment on a lot of things has slipped, including the business stuff. I think he's made a lot of brash decisions, a lot of bald moves that have put him in hot water. Well, I do not think he is a bad ad man. I think he may be still the best ad man there.
Well, Wiener actually said in several interviews that what he was trying to portray was that Don is actually slightly ahead of his time. Like, he's all, I mean, many of his campaigns are about the vivid colors that are made possible television, where he's like, thinking about the margarine, he's talking about you've got the yellowest corn, and he's talking about the best ad for Sunkist is an orange popping on television, and people are resistant that, and they're not getting it, and he's trying to go to a more mysterious, don't show the product.
Yeah,
make people want it by suggestion with the suggestion
like Heinz
and the Chevy ad that he was suggesting is headlights and people's reactions, but you don't actually see the car and it's build
and the
up.
Sheridan as well
that's shit that is going to be bread and butter of television. It's kind of like imagine like these really kooky Old Spice commercials they got now where the guy's got the two wolf heads on his shoulder and the crazy or Terry Crews stuff.
Flexing his pecs. Yeah.
That stuff would is undeniably brilliant. But imagine that early 90s.
Oh, yeah.
The culture wasn't there to support that level of nested irony to appreciate it.
Yep.
So I don't think he's lost any heat off his fastball, too. And when Matthew Weiner said that, I'm like, again, father of all lies. He is the great Satan. He is the master of dissemination misinformation. I actually think the only time he actually tells the truth are during these postseason breakdowns where he's basking in everyone's failed predictions. He's basking in all the critics, being chagrined that he's once again pulled off an amazing finale, and he's basically drunk on power and spit in truth.
And this is something we can see right on the screen.
Yeah. I mean,
he can't lie about what we've seen.
It's obvious in retrospect.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
They're
good. I'm glad I'm not the only one who thinks that. Bill goes on to say his fellow admin loved the lie of Don Draper. Much as the U.S. loves the lie of Don. The lie of the perfect 1950s family.
Which we talked about earlier on.
Yeah. He says, what good is an honest man in advertising, especially one as flawed as Don? This episode could have easily been the wrap-up to Don's story, as you can imagine him trying to turn his life around. Of course, I'm happy there will be a season 7, but I felt satisfied at the end of this episode. Great finale.
All right, I've rallied. You want me to take the next
couple?
We only got 3 left, I believe.
Okay.
Mary says, this episode is full of callbacks to previous past seasons, rather, showing that nothing is changing. They're just all circling with little change to their character. The song playing in the bar as Don drank himself away was Band of Gold, which was playing as a much younger Don sat drinking in a bar way back in season 1, episode 1. His office shot lingered on Don's silver-rimmed set of drinking glasses, which have miraculously made it through 9 years without having been broken by someone in a drunk accident.
That's a good point.
Nothing has changed in the last 8 years, except he is even more miserable now than he was then.
Mm.
Quick question. Was Harry Crane ever on East Coast this season, or did he literally phone in all of his performances?
He was there this episode.
Yeah, he was there this episode. Where else was he? Obviously, in the shouting match he had with Pete earlier on during the MLK fiasco assassination. He was there a lot.
But most of the time, yeah, he was on the West Coast.
He's clearly trying to cash in as many traveler checks on the West Coast as he possibly can.
We all know what those are used for.
Uh-huh. Jill says, like Sally and the boys, Don came from a home broken in an entirely different way, and he knows he's terribly broken as a result. He's worn out with hiding his brokenness. When he sees Ted desperately trying not to break his kids and his family and his home, Don showed something that's often in short supply in his character, compassion.
Yeah.
He's never really sought forgiveness from all the people he's carelessly broken, but he wants Sally to be able to understand him. Maybe they can heal together. Isn't it crazy how the made-up problems of these made-up people totally occupy our thoughts and imaginations? I have made a huge empty space that has been held by these characters, and I'm going to miss them for the next 40 weeks or so. It's like my group of friends are all moving away, and I can't call or go visit to see what they're up to next. This is the finest kind of writing. I imagine they're out there living their lives, and next spring I'll be able to catch up with them with what they've been doing. Miss you guys and your weekly audio date. Our weekly audio date. Hey, join us on Breaking Good.
Yeah.
It's fantastic in a completely different way from Mad Men.
Yeah, join Aaron on his newsroom podcast.
Shut the fuck up. I'm taking
that would
some
drive
week,
you crazy.
I'm taking some time off, thank you very much.
Oh, the show would just drive you insane, too.
Oh, well, it'd be another one that I'm kind of walking dead and up on. Although, nah, I'm not going to even go there.
Join me on the Falling Skies podcast.
There you go.
It's only in season 3. You can get caught up pretty easily.
There you go. Dave F. says, I wonder how long Ted and Jim have been planning the nudging out of Jesus Christ, Don. It was them that came up with the SC&P's partner's name, which conveniently covers them with the C, but even more conveniently eliminates any sign of the D in the name. Results in smooth transition with no name change if Don is ousted. What's your thoughts? I'm off on the whole Teddy having anything to do with ousting Don. Jim...
Yeah, Jim, he's a little suspect, right?
Yeah, Jim, I think, has been steering things behind the scenes this whole time. And the whole, this is going to be good for you, Teddy, at the, you know, when Don fucked up the...
This is a pretty good Hamlin. I'm with you.
I just tried to play Humperdinck.
I feel like there was a point where Jim went from, I want to fucking fire all of these guys, to kind of being on board. And I don't think that change was... real. I think
he wanted to co-opt.
He put on
all.
A face.
Yeah.
He put on a front there that said, oh, yeah, I'm playing ball with everybody while behind the scenes. I could definitely see what Dave's saying here.
Well, Roger and Bert might be slitting their own throats, too, because Don is the best defense against a voracious Jim Cutler, I think.
Oh, that's a good point. And Don's doing, like we said, some of the best work.
Which is one of our listeners pointed out a couple weeks ago, one of Teddy's pitches to Peggy was that Jim was getting ready to retire.
Yeah.
What the fuck? He does not seem like anywhere close to retiring.
No, he doesn't. I mean, shit, if Bert is still in the game, I don't think any of these guys are that close to retiring.
Dave continues, I've seen a lot of comments about the SC&P logo looking like the Price is Right logo, as in Lane Price is Right, as in they should all just hang themselves.
Yeah, I'll get behind that.
All right, final email. I remember hearing that Matthew Weiner talk about the season opener sometime around the premiere of season 5. He said the season premiere always sets the tone for the season to come and usually gives subtle, but in hindsight, obvious clues about what is to come in the season arc. If we go back to the season's opener, we saw Don seduced by the cleansing waters of Hawaii. In this last episode, we see all sorts of characters moving forward towards redemption. In the same interview, the Wiener said that, at least recently, the finale usually sets a tone for the next season. So are we looking at a Don Draper redemption via connection with his children in season 7? If that's the case, I'm prematurely saying I called it back in the better half when I wrote you guys saying that because Sally is his daughter, Don's typical woman equals mother whore formula doesn't apply, and his only salvation is connecting honestly with his children to break the cycle and prevent them from becoming him. Don told people about his past before, and he's never physically involved them in it, only his kids. They're the only ones who saw Anna Draper's house, and they're the only ones to see his childhood with their own eyes in the final episode of the season. Boy. I don't know, because preseason Wiener is the height of his manipulating bullshit mode. And also, I don't think that that's true. That's one of the things I'm worried about for next season, because he did take his kids out to beat Anna Draper. Did yeah. that lead to any genuine catalyst? Fuck no. I don't know. I feel like that he, a lot of times what we expect to see on the premiere from the previous season finale is usually inverted or the opposite. So I don't know that I believe him on that statement. What do you think, Jim?
Well, he has certainly shown us what he wants us to think, right? At the end of this, there is a glimmer of hope. And it centers, like Rachel says, in Don and Sally's relationship. I just find it so hard to believe the guy. And I didn't until you started saying that he's a lying bastard. And you're right. You're right, he lies a lot. So I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, if we are to believe the end of this, then yes, we will see next season he is repairing his relationship with everyone through his children, starting with his children.
She closes, doing an analysis predictions episode. Well, we weren't going to, but you talked us into it, Rachel. We got one more week of this. So if you've got any wrap-ups you'd like to talk, I think Jim and I are probably good for a half hour of talking about next season and looking back at this season. If you want to join in, send us those emails at madmen@baldmove.com. You can tweet stuff at Jim. He'll probably not use it because he's lazy that way. At Twitter, at baldmove.
It's just
same thing for me and Facebook.
It's hard to get a complex thought across in 140 characters.
Yeah, and it's really hard. Yeah. I do think that one thing we need to do better is integrating all of our different ways to do feedback. I mean, we lean heavily on email because it's the easiest to serialize.
Yeah.
We can grab it all out of our inbox and post it there and copy and paste, and it's all nicely formatted. You know, Facebook, I kind of keep up with in real time, so I don't feel like, you know, I got this, oh shit, if I don't use this on the podcast, it's like it never even happened. I mean, I'm...
That's the thing. I respond to everything on Twitter.
Yeah.
So, as much as I can, and I get a lot of it.
Every once in a while, like, you know, I remember that Triple L made the comment about Bob or Pete having the wide stance. And I made, because it was funny enough, I made reference to it, but I couldn't really remember who said it. And I feel like that's where I really let people down, when I bite their shit and I don't even give them credit. So I apologize for that. Try to do a better job going forward on stuff. But it's one of those things where, especially this year, this year is the first time you've actually compiled feedback, isn't it?
I think I've done it for another show, but yeah, for this show.
Yeah, so it's like I've always been the one. So, and since I'm kind of the Facebook caretaker, it's been natural for me to put that stuff in the notes. So it's something we'll get better at. Although the continuing challenge is we get more and more and more and more feedback every season and every show we do. And it's going to be to a point where we can't even pay lip service to reading it all. It's going to be, you know, you want your stuff read, you got to bring it. So fortunately, we're not at that point, because again, I think it's one of the best parts of our show is the listener interaction. And we hate when we don't have time to read everybody's stuff.
I feel like a lot of times listeners have better takes than I do.
Well,
even after having read all of the critic reviews and stuff.
Yeah, you put a couple thousand minds together and you can come up with some really cool stuff. I mean, it's been eerie that like the last two seasons worth of shows we've done, it feels like one of our listeners always calls the ending freakishly early. And it might be like the equivalent of a drunk guy at a Vegas, you know, Vegas casino booking a Super Bowl winner in June and then, you know, getting lucky and hitting the jackpot. But still, it's kind of impressive that there's always somebody's got a very eerily accurate take about something. And I think that's just a testament to what gets produced out of our community and is great.
Yeah.
So got to find a way to keep harnessing that.
Is that it? Are we done?
That's it.
That's
until
the end
next
of Mad
week,
Men for the season, man.
It's I feel the same way about Mad Men going off the air as I do like football. Because every other show almost leads directly into another show.
Yeah.
This is the only kind of real hiatus we have. And it sucks because I'm like, man, what in the hell am I going to be doing on Sunday nights? I mean, you got you've got the Space Homeland. What is it?
Space Homeland? Yeah. Falling Skies,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, it's got Adrian Brody, straps a vest, and tries to kill the alien terrorist.
No, it's got Noah Wiley strapped with a vest
with
killing
the vest,
alien
but still,
terrorists.
Still, vest, yeah, same
yeah, yeah.
thing.
Well, Steven Spielberg loves vests.
I got the newsroom I'm going to probably start commit to hate watching. Maybe it'll turn good, and I'll like watch it.
I hear on the DVD version of Falling Skies that all the guns are replaced with walkie-talkies.
That damn Spielberg.
Right.
Dude, this is no shit. We just hit a Macintosh computer file size limit for this podcast.
It's officially too long.
We have to shut it down. We're going to have to tear a couple bits out to make it work, apparently. What the hell, Steve Jobs?
Right.
What is this? 1998? You blew a 2 gigabyte file partition and your fat 32 thing.
Yeah,
dumped.
Man. I don't know. Apparently, it's a podcasting limitation. Anyway, thanks everybody for listening, and join us next week for season 6 wrap up cast. And until then, I'm Jim.
And I'm Aaron. I'll talk to you next week. ¶¶